Good. Let me just say a couple of words about the way this morning will work, and then we'll pray and dive in. Thank you for rushing your breakfast and getting here. It's just that with 66 books of the Bible, it does take slightly longer than those part-timers who are only doing one book of the Bible. We'll go from now till lunch. The aim is we'll have two short breaks rather than one long break. The first session will be slightly the longer, so I'm probably aiming to have a break at around 10:30. We'll have a 15-minute break, then we'll have another one at about 11:45-ish. So that's roughly the plan-ish, given or taken. We'll stop when I reach an appropriate point in my notes. I gather that Izzy needs to leave at 10 o'clock, so when she slips out, don't take it as a sign that she's so upset by what I'm saying. She may be, but we're trusting that that isn't the reason why she'll be leaving slightly early. Oh, very early. Let me just say two other things by way of intro. Firstly, I have terrible eyesight, so those of you who don't know me, if I have to look at my notes, I'll do something like that. Ignore that. Be nice and polite and British. The other thing is I love taking questions and engaging. So do think and ask questions. The problem is I love taking questions much too much. And whatever question you ask, I'll answer, and then we'll still be here at midnight, which would be a great shame because we'd miss lunch that way. So I'm going to ration the time when questions will be asked at certain points. So if you have a question, make a note, and I'd love to answer it, but hold it until the ration point, otherwise we won't finish. Any basic questions before we kick off? Why don't I pray for us, and then we'll dive in. Father God, thank you so much for the privilege of studying your whole word. Father, we know that you have revealed yourself in your word. You have spoken to us. You are speaking to us in your word. Father, as we try to understand what you're saying, as we look at all that your word teaches us about you and what you're doing, we pray, Father, for real clarity this morning, real faithfulness to your word, real excitement, Father, as we discover more about you and what you're doing, an excitement that will change us, an excitement that will change the way we teach, an excitement that will change the people we teach. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
Amen. Good. Sorry, Ali, I should have said, you're heading the slob group. Is there anything you want to say before I just launch into my spiel?
Not really, no. Go for it.
Go for it. I'm just the interloper. It's really Ali who sort of runs this. Actually, yes, and the handouts. And I've got too many sheets of paper here. There's some spares as well. And you would have one spare. Yeah, I think it was perfectly designed. I'll get you to read quite a few verses of the Bible just so you can see that what I'm saying, I hope, has at least some biblical support. Partly because my eyesight's so bad, if I read, you won't be able to hear, and partly to give my voice a break. When we read, I'll get you guys to read, and to save time, we'll just go around the table. Are you happy to do that? Or Pete, would you be prepared to read all of them for us? Because you've heard a lot of this material before.
Yeah, I'm happy to.
So Peter's are going to be our official reader. Are you sure you're happy with that?
Yeah, that's fine.
Good. Splendid. Good. Let me begin by saying that the overview, I think, is the most exciting thing we do at St. Helens. So I love Mark's Gospel, I love John's Gospel, I love Romans, but the overview is the most exciting thing we do. Because it's just a chance to see the whole picture of what God is doing. Whenever you do a book of the Bible, you're getting an angle, a particular facet of what God is doing, what God is revealing. When you look at the Bible as a whole, you're getting the whole thing. It is a lot more exciting. And also it's novel. Most people who have been at St. Helens, well, many, will have studied a book, at least they'll think they've studied a book, even if they haven't done it well. Most people have never even tried to study the Bible overview. The most they will have done is heard it at Word Alive or something like that, or Task. But they wouldn't actually have studied it for themselves. So there's a novelty and excitement about it. So I think you are in for a treat this year. Have any of you actually led the overview before?
I did last year.
You did? So you know. Have you all done an overview? Have you all done an overview? No, Ali, you haven't. Rich, you haven't.
It's not ironic.
Izzy, you have. Winston's,
yes.
You both have.
Yeah.
Jeff, you have. Good. Splendid. It is great fun. The aim of this morning's session, fairly obviously, is to begin to get a feel for the overview as a whole. Let me say a little bit about what an overview is and isn't. It isn't an attempt to get to do everything at a very shallow level. It isn't an attempt to do a representative sample of everything. It isn't a survey of all the material. What the overview is an attempt to get the storyline or plot of the Bible, the narrative that holds it all together. What we're trying to do in the overview is to see that the Bible is one coherent whole telling the story of the one God and his one great plan of history. Okay, so that's what we're trying to do in the year as a whole, and that's what we're going to try to do in this morning, to see in one sitting that it really does hold together. It really is coherent. It really does have a plot and a storyline. Seeing this overall plot or storyline is crucial precisely because the Bible is a story. God didn't reveal it as a set of books which are put in random order. If you took the books of the Bible, wrote them all in separate little pamphlets and shuffled them and then read them in a different order, you would not get the same story. You would not get the same revelation of God. The Bible is written, as you will see very clearly, with a beginning, a middle, and an end, and a plot which develops, which leads you through it. And like most stories or plots that develop, that has all sorts of implications. So when you have a plot, it doesn't necessarily go linearly from the beginning to an end. So if you think about a detective novel, there are all the way through the detective novel, you might get sort of false leads. The butler is suspected of doing it, and it takes five chapters until you discover actually he was innocent, even though he had motive and opportunity. But you're being led along to think maybe he is it. And the same to some extent is true in the Bible. So you just need to be aware of that. Whereas if you aren't aware of that sort of thing, the fact there's a plot, you might actually think, oh, well, if it says in page 20 that the butler might have done it, then of course the butler did do it. It'll be the same all the way through, rather than realizing it twists and turns as the story goes. Also, there's a sense of development. Things are put on the table and then superseded as time goes on. And again, you need to bear that in mind. Not always, but sometimes. When you realize you've got a story and a plot, you're at least open to that as a possibility for what might be happening. You can't say just because it turns up in chapter one, it must be superseded later on. Clearly, God is God all the way through. But clearly, you can't say because it turns up in the early chapters, it's got to be the same all the way through. We know there's some things that's not the case. That's why we don't offer lambs and bulls on an altar in Jerusalem these days. So some things definitely get superseded and some things definitely stay the same. And until you see the plot and how it works, it's very hard to work out how which things change and which things don't change and why things change and why things don't change. So until you see the plot of the Bible, it's very hard to be faithful to what God is actually revealing, as opposed to, if you like, imposing your own views on it. Assuming that either everything is superseded or nothing is superseded or everything goes flat. One of the implications of that is as you do the overview this year, don't jump ahead. So it's so tempting when you study bits of the Old Testament to say, oh, look, this reminds me of Jesus. That is the absolute classic. Oh, this reminds me of Jesus. But don't do that. Yes, it may be a prototype of Jesus, but very often that's not the point of the story, to be a prototype of Jesus. And if you jump ahead to Jesus, you will then miss what the story is actually doing. If you run with a plot of the story, I think we'll find that it actually revolutionizes our understanding of God and what he's doing. Let me just give you an example. It's fairly obvious that the problem is set up in Genesis 3. You get the fall, everything goes horribly wrong. So why didn't God send Jesus in Genesis 4? Why wait 1,000 pages of Revelation, however many thousands of years between Genesis 4 and 0 AD, before sending Jesus. It was for a reason. Because until God had revealed the whole Old Testament, we won't properly understand Jesus. And by jumping ahead to Jesus all the time, we never do fully understand Jesus. So most Christians know that Jesus is the answer. I don't think there's a genuine Christian anywhere who doesn't know that Jesus is the answer. But for most Christians today, well, certainly many Christians today, we don't know what the problem is to which Jesus is the answer. Which is why so many of the problems and confusions in the church today stem from knowing Jesus as the answer but being confused about the problem. Is the problem world poverty? Well, let's have liberation theology where Jesus comes along to restore social justice and equality. Is the problem ill health and personal tragedies? Well, Jesus solves those problems for you and you get a health wealth gospel. So many of the issues in the church today stem from knowing Jesus as the answer but not knowing the problem. The whole Old Testament is there to set up the problem that Jesus actually is the answer to. And that's just one example out of hundreds of the way that reading the plot forward will help you understand Jesus and what he's doing so much more clearly than if you don't do it that way. God knew what he was doing when he revealed the Old Testament before sending Jesus. The other thing that will be the case if you read the whole Bible and try to get a feel of the plot, is you'll understand much more clearly what is big in the Bible and what is little in the Bible. There are a lot of truths in the Bible and they're all true, but they're not all of the same weight. And again, a lot of confusion in the church down history has come from making the big things little and the little things big. So some heresies come from ignoring what's in the Bible. Some heresies come from adding things to the Bible. But a lot of heresies come from just distorting the Bible. How do you work out what's big and what's small? Well, it could be from your church tradition or your background, but that's not a good way of doing it. The much better way is let's have a look at what the Bible says is big and small. And the only way to do that is to get a feel for the book as a whole. And then you think, okay, now that I know the whole plot, I can see what's big in this. What are the big turning points in the plot? And what is just a throwaway little incident on the side within the plot? So again, that's another example for why doing the overview is such a key thing to do. It's also key to dealing with some of the biggest theological challenges of our time. I'll come to that at the end of the morning session, so I won't give you a taste of that. I'll just tell you that I think some of the biggest theological challenges of our time get answered if you understand the overview, and we'll come back to that at the end of the morning. But just be aware that as you do the overview, both in this morning's, if you like, overview of an overview and the whole year, it is not an academic exercise. It really has very profound ramifications for dealing with heresy, for clarifying our own understanding, for just exciting us far more as we understand what Jesus is actually, what role Jesus is actually playing in God's plan, what God actually is doing all the way through. Any questions? This is a short question break.
Apart from what the theological challenges are.
which I'll come to. Any others? Good. There will be lots later, so if you haven't got any, I'll press on. Let's now go back and look at the plot line of the Bible. So that was by way of preamble. Why do we bother? I can't resist a digression here. It's so important to be clear about what we're trying to do. I think if we're not clear about what we're trying to do, then we won't actually achieve it, which is why I think it's really worth, in your minds, being really clear what you're trying to achieve in the year and holding that at the front of your mind, because that will then enable you to achieve it much more. If you lose sight of the fact that the thing we're trying to do is get the plot of the Bible, it'll be so easy for your RML studies over the year just to degenerate into each study stands alone. And we're looking at some of the plum passages of the Bible, so they'll be exciting studies, but people won't come away with the idea of a coherent plot. But the coherent plot is what the whole object of the exercise, not 27 or whatever it is, really exciting random passages. So what the overview is not is the 27 most exciting passages in the Bible, even though the 27 passages we're choosing are 27 of the most exciting passages of the Bible. So let's go back and make sure we're really clear on what the plot of the Bible as a whole is. And the way we begin to get that is by looking at the beginning and the end. Like most books, if you get an idea of the beginning and the end, you know what sort of book you're dealing with. Is it a tragedy? Are they all dead on the last page? Is it a story of triumph and heroic victory, in which the good have triumphed in the end and the baddies are defeated? Is it a romance? Are they all married off in the end? How does it work? So an idea of the beginning and the end will give you some sort of feel of what sort of plot, what sort of narrative you're dealing with. In Genesis 1 and 2, you see God creating the world. He does it effortlessly with just a word. It is exactly as he wants it. It is very, very good. And he creates humanity as the pinnacle of his creation. And he relates to humanity in a very special way. He relates, he rules us as he does the rest of creation, but he also loves us and cares for us and gives us huge responsibilities in a way that he doesn't to the rest of the world. So it's Adam and Eve who are given responsibility to rule and look after the world. It's Adam and Eve, it's Adam who he looks at and says, you need a wife, I'll make sure I'll give you one. It's Adam and Eve to whom he gives responsibility of breeding and filling the world, to whom he gives a home. So there's a real care and a love and a giving of responsibility. Humankind are in a special position. In Genesis 3, however, it all goes horribly wrong. Adam and Eve rebel against God. His love, his trust, his care are all thrown back in his face. And as a result, God punishes Adam and Eve, and the good world is spoiled. So first and foremost, the great relationship between God and humankind is spoiled. Instead of God caring for, loving for, seeking the good of Adam and Eve, he is angry and sends them away and condemns them to pain and toil. Pete, can you read Genesis 3, 16 to 19? Even though Pete's the one doing the reading, you might all want to follow it in your Bibles just to make sure that it really is saying it there, that Pete and I haven't colluded to put things in that aren't there.
16 to 19.
Yes, please.
To the woman, he says, I will surely multiply your pain in childbearing. In pain you shall bring forth children. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. And to Adam he said, because you have listened to the voice of your wife, and have eaten of the tree of which I commanded you, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread, till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return.
Thank you. So can you see that whereas in Genesis 2, God is really for humankind. He sees Adam is alone. It's not good. He seeks to solve the problem. Now, he's actually against them. And he's basically saying, all the stuff I gave you to do, you know, to work the ground, it's going to be hard and it's full of thorns and thistles and stones. Having children, it's going to be painful and unpleasant. Life is going to end. You're going to die. In all sorts of ways, he's now against them instead of for them. And he drives them from the home that he gives them. Can you read verses 22 to 24, please?
Then the Lord God said, behold, the man has become like one of us in knowing good and evil. Now, lest he reach out his hand and take also the tree of life and eat and live forever. Therefore, the Lord God sent him out from the Garden of Eden to work the ground from which he was taken. He drove out the man, and at the east of the Garden of Eden, he placed the cherubim and a flaming sword that turned every way to guard the way to the tree of life.
Brilliant, thank you. So relationship broken, driven out of the home and prevented from returning, and cursed. Can you read 3:14, please?
The Lord God said to the serpent, because you have done this, cursed are you above all livestock and above all beasts of the field. On your belly you shall go, and dust you shall eat all the days of your life.
Thank you. So the serpent is cursed. And can you read the second half of verse 17 again, please?
Because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten of the tree of which I commanded you, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life.
Thank you. So creation is clearly cursed. The serpent is cursed. The land is cursed. I want to argue humans are cursed as well. So this is a controversial issue. A lot of people will say, but it doesn't say humans are cursed. The creation is cursed is not that controversial, certainly not in evangelical circles. Humans are not cursed, they'll say. That's very significant. Once you're told that everything God has given you to do is going to be hard and miserable and it's cursed around you, and that you're going to die, and that you're going to be thrown out of the land that God's given you, if that isn't curse, what is curse? So I reckon that humans effectively are cursed, even though the word cursed is not used. But you can go away and have a mull on that one. Instead of living forever, humans now die. So you can see that, I won't get Pete to read this because he's read it already. You can see that in verse 19 and again in verses 22 to 24. From dust you came, to dust you will return, you will die. So, if you like, we can put this up on the board, actually. Where's the blue tack on? That's it. I reckon that may be enough. Let's see. I won't put that up yet. I'll put it up later. Sorry, confusion. So basically you've got four categories there where you see everything going wrong because God is now against humankind. Their relationship is broken, they're driven from their home, they're cursed, and they die. And all this happens because Adam and Eve rebel against God. That is the cause of it all. Sin. I am going to put this up, but in writing. So you've got these categories, if you like. You've got relationship with God broken, ruined. You've got Eden lost. You've got cursed. And you've got to die. And all of it is because, change of color. Of sin. And it's really worth holding in your mind all the way through the overview. It's really important you hold in your mind all the way through that this is the problem, but the problem comes in two halves. There's the green sin that causes the problem, and the red, if you like, effects, results of that, God's response to that sin of curse, ejection from Eden, death, and a broken relationship with himself. So hold in your mind that there are two sides to the problem. Our sin and God's response, which have now wrecked this world that we live in, that God made. When you look at the end of the story in Revelation 21:22, we'll see that all the things that go wrong, that went wrong at the fall, have been put right in the new creation. So let's go to Revelation 21:22. And the first, so Revelation 21:22. And Pete, can you read 21 verses 3 and 4 for us, please?
And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people. And God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain any more. For the former things have passed away."
So can you see that God once again is now their God and he's for them? Instead of, so in Genesis 3, he's giving them tears and making life miserable. Now his job is taking them away and making sure there's nothing like that again. Once again, he is for them. And once again, he's giving them a wonderful home to dwell in. Can you read verses 1 and 2, please? 21.
Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, adorned for her husband.
Thank you. So there's now a new heaven and a new earth, a new home, for which they can come into. It's a city, not a garden. We'll think about that briefly in a bit. There are differences as well as similarities, but they now have a place they can call home again. And they get blessing, not curse. So 21:4, Pete's read for us, there's nothing cursed. Pete, can you read 22:3, please?
No longer will there be anything accursed, but the throne of God and of the Lamb will be in it, and his servants will worship him.
Thank you. So repeated idea. There's nothing accursed in it. The curse has been dealt with. And there's no death. Again, 21:4 said there was no death. Can you read 22:2, please?
Through the middle of the street of the city, also on either side of the river, the tree of life, with its 12 kinds of fruit, yielding its fruit each month. The leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations.
Thank you. So can you see that in Genesis 3, not only were they told that they would die, they were precluded from being allowed access to the tree of life. Now the tree of life is slap bang in the middle of the city that we will dwell in, available for all of us at all times of the year. So no death. And there's nothing sinful in it. If you read 21:27, please.
But nothing unclean will ever enter it, nor anyone who does what is detestable or false, but only those who are written in the Lamb's Book of Life.
Thank you. So there's nothing sinful in the city. So can you see how everything that went wrong in Genesis 3, when you look at Revelation 21:22, it's put right, and in a very explicit sort of way. Cursed, nothing accursed. You will die, not have access to the tree of life. There'll be no death, you will have access to the tree of life. I am against you and hostile and going to make life miserable. I'm going to wipe away every tear and be your God. There's a real sort of explicit oppositeness when you reach the end of the story compared to the beginning of the story. That's where the whole thing is heading, to a restoration. Now, there are other things that are happening as well. So we're going to track those four things that God punishes man with, and sin. There are other things you can add to that as well. That is a simplified version of the whole Bible story, obviously. I'm going to do it in about 3 hours. We're going to do it in 27 studies. God took 1,200 pages and however many thousand years to reveal it. God doesn't waste words. To put it into this compressed form, we have left out all sorts of things. And the things we have left out are interesting and exciting and true. And some of them are even very important. But the danger with the Bible overview is you try to put too much in and you lose the plot. So one, your big challenge this year as leaders is not to put extra things in. When you study books of the Bible, seeing a new interesting angle is not an easy thing to do, and it's quite an exciting thing to do, and it doesn't cause too much harm to raise it. In the overview, seeing new and exciting things is trivial. There are hundreds of new and exciting things. It is not a difficult exercise to see new angles. The difficult exercise is working out which the key angles are to make sure that you keep the coherent plot and see the main lines of the plot. Does that make sense? And it is a real challenge. Depending on how your mind works, it can be an even bigger challenge. Some people, I just love seeing new angles. When you see a new angle, you think, oh, isn't that exciting? Let me put that in as well. They'd be so thrilled if they see this as well. But actually, the answer is when somebody's doing it for the first time, they aren't that thrilled when they see all these extra angles. They just get overwhelmed with information, facts, and data. And it is much, with the overview, more than any other thing you do in the Bible, it is much better for that to be built up layer by layer over the years. So the first time you go through it, just get the basics. And then the second time, you can add extra things. So if you're doing it for the second or third or fourth time, you will see lots of new angles. And that is a really good thing. That's the whole object of the exercises, for you to see new angles. Don't teach them. Be thrilled by it for yourself. But remember, the people in your groups are where you were the first time you did it. And they will be most excited to get most out of the year if they get the basic plot. So I fall into the besetting sin of using analogies in fields that are not my own. So I'll take the risk and use something from medicine. When you're first studying the human body, you need to know the big bones and the big skeleton. You don't need to know all the little bones and little nerves and little muscles. And they may be very fascinating to think, oh, that little muscle means this happens. But when you're first studying the human body, you need to know there's a spinal cord with a skull at the top and a few big bones making the limbs. And it's the same with a Bible story. They will get so much more out if they see the big things clearly. Which doesn't mean repeating the same things week after week. It doesn't mean being simplistic. Getting that balance right isn't always easy. But keep in the forefront of your mind, are they getting the big plot? If they ever begin to lose the big plot, is it because I'm overcomplicating? How can I simplify? Does it make sense? Actually, let me just say a little bit more and then I'll open it up for questions again. Just to note how, as you look at the Bible, you can add layers on, and some are important and some aren't. So at the most basic level, you have a problem set up in Genesis 3, which is all resolved by the time you reach Revelation 21, 22. There are some differences in Revelation 21, 22, some things like it's a city, not a garden, and there's significance in that. Some of the differences, there are lots of differences. They're almost all significant. They almost all matter. Some are much bigger than others. So things like the fact it's a city, not a garden, you don't have to do anything with, I think, in an RML Bible overview. There are one or two differences that really, really matter. And the one that matters most is that Jesus is now on the throne with the Father in the new creation. So, Pete, can you read 22 verses 1 and 3, please?
Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life, bright as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb. No longer will there be anything accursed, but the throne of God and of the Lamb will be in it, and his servants will worship him.
Thank you. So the Son is there, Jesus is there, and not only there, he is on the throne with God. And the people, the church, the city, is his bride. Can you read 21 verses 9 and 10, please?
Then came one of the seven angels, who had the seven bowls full of the seven last plagues, and spoke to me, saying, "Come, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb." And he carried me away in the spirit to a great high mountain, and then showed me the holy city Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God.
Thank you. So Jesus has a very central place in the new creation, and that's a new angle. Now, we know from the rest of the Bible that he was there in Genesis 1 to 3. He was instrumental in the creation. He's obviously there from the beginning. But as you read Genesis 1 to 3, he's not there explicitly anywhere. When you read Revelation 21 and 22, he is explicitly at the center everywhere. It is one of the many differences between Revelation 21 and Genesis 3, but it's the one that really matters that we need to keep our eye on. So, if you like, that's the beginning and the end. Everything is restored. Can you see this, by the way?
Yeah,
I thought you could. But that one is added. So we now know what the Bible storyline is. The Bible storyline is, how does God put right everything that went wrong in Genesis 3? And how does Jesus end up slap bang in the middle as the linchpin of the new creation when we get to it? That's what the story is about. And that's what, as we work through the whole Bible, that's what we need to make sure comes out at all times. How the restoration happens and how Jesus turns up as central. Does that make sense? Any questions?
stop yourself from seeing something that excites you a lot, and you think because it's exciting, it is the big thing? That's the thing I find quite
Yeah, it is very hard.
That's what I often think go for is the thing that I think is quite new, looks very interesting.
Yeah.
Is probably going to be the big thing in my mind.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not sure I've got a simple answer to that. The simple answer in practice, I suppose, is to some extent have the humility to realize this is your first time teaching it, and just because you got excited this first time, don't think therefore they'll get excited by it, but almost sort of say, well, maybe there's some acquired wisdom down the years, let's stick with the party line. But that's the easy answer to implement, but I don't personally like it as an answer because it goes against every instinct in my being, which is don't trust what other people tell you, but work it out for yourself. So I don't have a good answer to your question, because the answer that works is also an answer that I don't like, if that makes sense. But I think it's a genuine challenge. And in some ways, nobody ever said Bible teaching was easy. Okay, so those of you who were here last night, one of a challenge leading the Bible, RML, teaching the Bible is very hard work at all sorts of levels. And we are used to the level of it's hard work. I have to stay up late, I have to sweat at the end of a day's work, also all those things. One of the challenges maybe we're not used to is we need to wrestle with, I've got excited, but is that therefore the most important thing to teach? Which you will find all the way through when you're preaching a sermon. Every time a sermon preacher preaches, he has that challenge. And it's a balance, because if you don't just want to preach the standard line, because your congregation will get bored, but you don't just want to always preach the novel and interesting angle, because they'll never learn the basics. And that's one of the challenges.
One thing that can hopefully make it slightly easier is we've got the slob study to explore a bit more of a kind of new angle or a new thing we've seen, get a bit of it together, and then kind of together work out how are we going to make sure we're teaching our groups what they need to see in terms of the whole plot line.
It is real that the number of times I turned up to slob last year being like, yeah, and then be like, okay, I'll just go and study that one again. I'm doing that study.
I hope we do that in a way that's not like just squash.
Yeah, it actually is that the biggest thing.
That's exciting,
thing.
But
we
let's try and all get
it. Is it that more or is it that more?
Good. Now I'm going to press on. You need to leave in about 5 minutes, is that right?
Yeah.
There's a good break point in about 5 minutes if I can motor on. Good. So basically, the Bible isn't a tragedy. The Bible is the story of great triumph and great romance. It's how God defeats the enemy. Satan is seen off, and we haven't looked at it, but in Revelation 20, is thrown into the pit of sulfur, and there's nothing evil in the new creation. And it's a story of great romance. The son marries the bride at the end of the story. So it's a tremendously exciting book. It's a book where at the end, God and his people are in a wonderful new relationship. Everything has been put right. Everything is wonderful. We live happily ever after. It's the ultimate happy ending, and it is a true happy ending, unlike Hollywood happy endings. But now let's go back to the beginning and see that to get to that happy ending, there are a lot of twists and turns and unhappinesses and problems on the way. In Genesis 4 to 11, we see that sin and death are universal. Adam and Eve's sin is not a one-off. As early as Genesis 4, murder turns up. By Genesis 6, God's verdict on the world is that intentions of the human heart are only evil all the time. That is a very, very damning statement of the condition of humankind. And you see that all the way through the Bible, and you see that in the world today. Sin is endemic everywhere. And as early as Genesis 6, God responds to that by punishing people with the flood. And he starts again with Noah. What's the flood doing? Let's just take this almost as a case study of how you have to think about how something functions in the plot rather than just on its own as an incident. The flood is one of the most exciting little incidents in the Bible. There is no Sunday school in the country, probably, that doesn't teach the flood at some point to children, just because it is such fun to have Noah building this ark and the animals going in two by two. But why is it in the Bible story? What's it doing there? Think about it for a moment. Humans today, we look at the world and we try to fix it. And what do we say the problem is? Other horrid people, let's lock them up in jail. The fact that there's sin around, if we could only improve the environment, things would be much better. Let's change the environment, let's change society, let's do a bit of social engineering. Use a politically, I think, incorrect term, but basically that's what it is. Let's do a bit of social engineering to make the world better. And if only we did the right things, the world would be much better. Isn't that basically what most of the people say most of the time? This is the ultimate act of social engineering. For God to get rid of everybody except the most righteous man in the world and his family, so there's no other people around that family to lead them astray, no bad influences, they've all been gotten rid of. To wash the whole world and to start again and give it a washed world to the most righteous family, there is nothing more radical. I mean, that is radical beyond the extremes that you could conceive of, isn't it? And it doesn't work. By Genesis 11, we're back to the status quo. They're all sinning all the time again. So when God begins his plan to put things right in Genesis 12, it is something more radical than the most extreme act of social engineering you could conceive of. So just think of it in terms of the Bible story, and it shows you the magnitude of what God is actually doing in his salvation plan that begins with Abraham. It is more extreme than the flood, which, by the way, just puts in perspective everything that humans do to try to put the world right. If God's act that extreme didn't do it, we're wasting our time with everything else we try to do. Let's have a look at what God is doing and run with that, because that actually does work, as you can see, by the time we reach Revelation 21:22. Does that make sense? So that's just an example of when you do the flood, when you do every incident, don't just look at it on its own. You could have such fun with Noah and the animals, and this is a rescue, and Noah was faithful, but you've lost the whole point, which is to set up how big God's plan actually is when it kicks in four chapters later. And the radical plan begins in Genesis 12 as God chooses one man and makes some promises to him of reversing what has gone wrong. Until this point, there has been really no hope. People say in Genesis 3:15 that there is hope. Promise that there'll be a serpent crusher. But actually, it's not a promise of any good for humankind. It's just a promise of bad for the serpent. His head's going to get smashed. And until then, there's no hope. Noah is not told that things will be better when he comes out of the ark. He's just told that if he doesn't build the ark and get in it, he will die alongside everyone else. There's no promise of any improvement for the first 11 chapters from Genesis 3 to Genesis 11. Genesis 12 is the first hint of any hope at all. That's why it's such a significant turning point in the Bible. But what is promised to Abraham? So why don't we spend 5 minutes in pairs just looking at what is promised to Abraham and how it compares to what went wrong at the fall. And this is your moment to leave. So, have fun. So have a look at the following passages. Genesis, actually I don't want that, sorry. Genesis 12, 1 to 7, 13, 14 to 17, and 17, 3 to 8. Don't cheat. On the handout in front of you are the answers. Don't look at them. Look at the Bible and try to work. Well, they're what I think are the answers. So look at the Bible and see what the real answers are. The question that you have is, in those passages, what is promised to Abraham and how does it compare to what went wrong at the fall? And you have 5 minutes. Good. Everybody, are we there? Are we, again, if you haven't reached 17, make sure you get to chapter 17. Everybody there?
Yeah.
Brilliant. Good. Sorry, I'm going to drag us together because I'm running out of time. So this. So what? Let's just work through those categories. What happens to the relationship with God?
In chapter 17, he says, "I will be God to you." So there's a sort of restoration. It's definitely not anywhere near like it was in Eden.
Brilliant.
You've got covenant.
You've got covenant. You've got he will be their God. They will be his people. Can you read 17, 7 and 8 to us, please?
And I will establish my covenant between me and your offspring after you throughout their generations for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and to your offspring after you. And I will give to you and to your offspring after you the land of your sojournings, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God.
Thank you. So you get some sort of restoration, at least, of relationship with God. What about land?
In that verse 8 in chapter 17, you've got the land for an everlasting possession.
Brilliant. I'll give you the land as an everlasting possession. Yeah.
More developed than what it was in 12, right? Just was mentioned as a thing you'll have.
Yeah. Yep. So you'll have the land, you'll have it as an everlasting possession. Good. What happens? What's happened to the curse?
So you get a lot of blessings in chapter 12, 2 and 3.
Brilliant. Can you read 12, 2 and 3, Rich, please?
Yeah. And I'll make of you a great nation, and I'll bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I'll bless those who bless you, and him who dishonours you I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed.
Brilliant. So, lots of blessing. And what about death? This is the hard one, and I heard at least one group discussing it. What's happened to death? Anything or not?
So there's something related, but it's only partial. So you've got lots of descendants, lots of offspring, family of many nations, which is kind of linked in that you're in that God's saying, rather than decline and death, you're going to have children and life.
Yes.
But it's not fixing the problem of every person.
No. Brilliant. It doesn't fix the problem of every person dies, but he will have descendants down the generation. And in most cultures still, and certainly most cultures in history and that culture, that people live in their descendants. That's why people are so passionate about having children. And that's why if you die and you don't have children and your money goes to your nephew, it's not the same thing as I have an heir who is mine. And that's why people are so excited about their own children. So there is a sense in which you may die, but if you have children, you live on in them. But it's very partial. Actually, they're all pretty partial. So they promised the land of Canaan. They lost the land of Eden. And the promised land, Canaan, is okay, but it's a fairly scrubby bit of the Middle East, if we're honest about it.
I was thinking that's a digression, but I was thinking it's extraordinary all the stuff about kind of land, fluid, milk and honey and so on. It's not a particular place.
But the Jordan River was much bigger in those days than it is now. So it was much more fertile.
But even if it was, if you've just come out of the... If you've just come out of the desert,
yeah.
By comparison, it's pretty good. So let's put it up. So this diagram is going to run and run. And when we have a better board, it'll run even more. But basically you have, if you like, God create, you get creation... You get the fall. I'll draw it as a squiggle to say it's a very big thing. Things go along. You get the flood, but that actually doesn't solve anything. You go along. So, flood, fall. And at the end of the story, you get new creation. And I'm going to put it, top high is good. So new creation is better because it's... than the old creation. It's not just that everything is put right. Sorry? It's much better. Which we haven't had a chance to look at properly, but you can take my word for it. You'll have to take my word for it for the moment. What happens here is you get a promise to Abraham. And it's a promise of some sort of restoration of what went wrong, but it's not the full thing. Also, I put it in a different colour because it's only a promise. Abraham doesn't experience that right away. His experience continues much as it was before God made the promise. So you have two things now on the table. One, you've got, well, several things. You've got a beginning of a promise of a restoration, and it's so significant because it's the first time in the story that you know things might get better. Until then, at best they'd stay the same, and at worst they could get very much worse. Now you realize God is saying he's going to make things better. And it's better in exactly the same ways that this wrong happened. It's not sort of better in a different dimension altogether. But it's only partial, and it's for the future. Just notice several things. Let's put this up. So this is where we are now. It's part two. Nothing is mentioned about sin, really, at this point. God has said he'll do something about all the results of the fall, but he's not said anything about the problem, the cause, sin. Nor has Jesus really turned up. Now, this is, let me just pause here, because this is a classic example of where you can see extra detail. You can say, but he's promised a son, Isaac, and we know from Galatians 3 when we get there that that's a foretaste of Jesus. And you can add all that complexity in. And it is true. But it's not Jesus in the sense that we will see Jesus being later in the story. And to bring Jesus in at this point will confuse rather than make the basic plot clearer. Similarly, there are some mentions of sin which you could bring in. Abram is told that he needn't sin, but it doesn't turn up in the way that sin will turn up later on. So it's one of those things that if you bring it in here, you are not wrong, but you're losing the big plot, because when sin turns up in the Mosaic Covenant, which we'll see in 10 minutes' time, it turns up in a huge way, so much bigger than here, that to bring it in here will just confuse the plot. Ditto when Jesus turns up in the promise of the king, he turns up in such a big way, which is so obviously fulfilled in the New Testament, that to bring it up as a fulfillment of Isaac confuses and loses the big plot. Does that make sense? So this is a place where the more you know the story, the more you can add extra layers in. But actually, to bring it in too early for somebody who doesn't know the big plot will confuse rather than clarify. And getting that balance right is the big challenge of the overview, not seeing the extra. Does that make sense? Any questions at this point? Good, I'll press on. We are behind schedule already. Those of you who know me will know that that is a normal state of affairs. So God is promising Abraham some reversal of the fall in every area that he punished human beings at the fall. This is the Abrahamic covenant, and it is one of the most important covenants in the whole Bible. But the reversal is only partial. Canaan is not Eden. Abraham's line continuing is not the same as him living forever. It's the beginning of the solution. It is not the whole story, but it is the beginning of a solution. And you can already begin to see some of the questions that you have on the table for the future as the story goes forward. So how will that partial promise of, or the promise of a partial restoration turn into the full restoration and more? How will God actually achieve fulfilling the promises? How will that gap between current experience and what is promised get bridged? What about sin, which caused the problem? So sin caused a problem. We'll put it in a different color, green again. Sin was what drove them down there. What's happened to that? Has he just basically said, oh, well, that didn't work, me saying you shouldn't sin. We'll settle for something smaller where sin isn't a problem? Isn't any sin? How is it going to work? Wait and see. But those are some of the questions we now have. This promise is even though it's so early in the story, it's the turning point in the history of the world, because for the first time, there's some indication that there's a way back. There are all sorts of questions. I've given you three. Yet another is, who is going to benefit from all of this? So everybody was affected by the fall. Who's going to benefit from the promise to Abraham? Explicitly, it's Abraham's descendants. There is a clue that all nations will be blessed through you, but how does that work when the promises of restoration are actually to Abraham and his descendants? Wait and see. And the rest of the Bible is about how God fulfills these promises, what happens to sin, and who exactly Abraham's descendants are. For the next 400 years, Abraham and his descendants do not inherit what God has promised. In fact, things get worse. They go down to Egypt as initially as welcomed guests. They turn into slaves. By the time you reach the beginning of the book of Exodus, they are slaves in a land that's not their own. So they've got no blessing, really. They're slaves, having a miserable life. They have no land. They're not even in the land, fathers owning any of it. There seems to be not much by way of relationship with God that you can see in the beginning of Genesis, beginning of Exodus. The one thing you do have is lots of descendants. There are too many of them. That's right, there are a lot of them. But God intervenes again at the beginning of Exodus with, if you like, at this intervention, it's just a promise. At the beginning of Exodus, he actually intervenes to act. So there's a, keep in mind the difference between what he promises and reveals and his actions. They're not the same thing, and it's worth tracking the two separately. Up to this point, in terms of actions, there's not been a lot. There's a destruction, and there's been some descendants, but that's it. But a lot of promises. But in the start of Exodus, we start getting some real action. God rescues his people from Egypt in the Exodus. He leads Israel through the desert to Mount Sinai, and there he makes another covenant with them as he tells them what it means to be his people, how they can inherit what is promised to Abraham. He makes basically the Mosaic covenant. So at the Exodus, God isn't simply rescuing people from something out of Egypt. He's rescuing them for something, the fulfillment of the promises to Abraham. And that is very significant because Noah is rescued from something, death and the flood and destruction. But Noah isn't promised anything that he's rescued for. It is just, you will not die, this bad thing won't happen. When you get to the Exodus, you get this extra dimension of something good will happen as well as the bad will end. And that's very significant. That's why when we think about rescue now in the New Testament, we very often focus on you're rescued from sin and judgment and hell. But actually, what you're rescued for, eternal life, new creation, everything put right, is at least as important. And I think, don't give it enough emphasis. God is beginning now to fulfill the promise to them of the reversal of the fall. In the Mosaic covenant, God re-promises all the elements of the Abrahamic covenant. So let's have a look at that. Pete, can I put you on reading duty again? Are you happy with being on reading duty? Can you do Deuteronomy 28? So for those of you who've done overview in the last few years, you focused on Leviticus 26. This year we're going to shift for various reasons to Deuteronomy 28, which will become clearer in a bit. They're both Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28 are great summaries of the Mosaic covenant. That's why we focus on them. And in some ways they're interchangeable, but there's one reason why Deuteronomy is better. I'll come to it in a moment. So let's look at the re-promising of these things. So the relationship with God is re-promised in Deuteronomy 28, verses 9 and 10.
The Lord will establish you as a people, holy to himself, as he has sworn to you, if you keep the commandments of the Lord your God and walk in his ways. And all the peoples of the earth shall see that you are called by the name of the Lord, and they shall be afraid of you.
Thank you. So they will be gods. Everybody will see that they are gods and be afraid. They will get land and blessing. Can you read verse 8, please?
The Lord will command the blessing on you in your barns and in all you undertake, and he will bless you in the land that the Lord your God is giving you.
Thank you. And they'll have many people. Can you read verse 11, please?
And the Lord will make you abound in prosperity, in the fruit of your womb and in the fruit of your livestock and the fruit of your ground within the land that the Lord swore to your fathers to give you.
Thank you. So in the middle of that verse about blessing, you get the fruit of your womb. You will have lots of descendants. So he's basically restating everything he promised to Abraham. The Mosaic Covenant is a huge covenant. The covenant with Noah, there is a covenant with Noah, which we didn't look at, just of not flooding the world again, takes one verse. The covenant with Abraham takes about three chapters. The covenant with Moses starts in Exodus 19 and goes right through to Deuteronomy 28. It takes about 3.5 books. It is not the whole of the Pentateuch. And that's worth remembering. We'll come to that in a second. The Mosaic Covenant doesn't, though, just re-promise what is in the Abrahamic Covenant. It extends and develops the Abrahamic Covenant in two ways. First of all, it spells out and extends the promises. Specifically, the relationship with God that is promised is now made much clearer, and you realize what a good thing it will be. And this is the one place where the Leviticus passage is better than the Deuteronomy passage. So, Pete, could you read Leviticus 26, verse 11 and 12, please? But don't lose the Deuteronomy passage. We'll come back to that in a second.
26.
11 and 12.
I will make my dwelling among you, and my soul shall not abhor you. I will walk among you and will be your God, and you shall be my people.
Thank you. That's clear, A, because of the same language that's used in Genesis 17 of I will be your God, you'll be my people. And secondly, introduces the idea of him dwelling with them, which is a very big thing in the Mosaic Covenant and the building of the tabernacle and all the rest of it. So that's a really big thing. It's a better promise. More is now being promised. So, if you like, the story now goes as follows. Is that black or red?
Black.
Black, brilliant. And that is as black as well, isn't it? So, they go there, things get worse, then they get rescued in the Exodus. And as God rescues them, he makes a new covenant with them, which is the Mosaic Covenant. And it is better. We're moving more towards full restoration of what got lost. God will dwell with them, and he'll walk with them, which is what he did in the Garden of Eden. So that's one of the ways in which the Mosaic Covenant extends the Abrahamic Covenant. Much more importantly, sin now comes in as an issue. Conditions are attached. Let's go back to Deuteronomy 28. Pete, can you read verses 1 and 2 and also 13 and 14, please?
And if you faithfully obey the voice of the Lord your God, being careful to do all his commandments that I command you today, the Lord your God will set you high above all the nations of the earth, and all these blessings shall come upon you and overtake you if you obey the voice of the Lord your God. And the Lord will make you the head and not the tail, and you shall only go up and not down if you obey the commandments of the Lord your God, which I command you today, being careful to do them. And if you do not turn aside from any of the words that I command you today, to the right hand or to the left, to go after other gods to serve them.
Thank you. So they will only get those blessings if they obey. So now you suddenly discover that that is if obey. What happens if they don't obey? Let's have a look at what happened. Because there's an if they don't obey as well, which is really crucial, which is also in Deuteronomy 28, really clearly, which is one of the pluses of Deuteronomy 28. First of all, he'll send more curses against them. Pete, can you read 28, verses 58 to 61?
If you are not careful to do all the words of this law that are written in this book, that you may fear this glorious and awesome name, the Lord your God. Then the Lord will bring on you and your offspring extraordinary afflictions. Afflictions severe and lasting, and sickness grievous and lasting. And he will bring upon you again all the diseases of Egypt, of which you were afraid, and they shall cling to you. Every sickness also and every affliction that is not recorded in the book of this law, the Lord will bring upon you until you are destroyed.
Thank you. So that's pretty stark description of the curses God will bring upon them, extraordinary afflictions until you are destroyed. And he will kill off the people and take away their land. Can you read 62 and 63, please?
Whereas you were as numerous as the stars of heaven, you shall be left few in number, because you did not obey the voice of the Lord your God. And as the Lord took delight in doing you good and in multiplying you, so the Lord will take delight in bringing ruin upon you and destroying you, and you shall be plucked off the land that you are entering to take possession of it.
Thank you. Just look at that. It's not saying that he won't give them anything new. He's saying things like, you are already a large number of people, but I'm going to kill you off. I'm about to give you this land, and you, at this point, they're on the border of the land in Deuteronomy 28. They're going to go in a few months' time. And he's saying, that's definitely going to happen. You're going to get the land. But if you disobey, I'm going to take it away from you and take it, throw you out of it. So it's not just a case of I won't give you any more blessings if you disobey. It is even what I have given you will be removed if you disobey. And most shocking of all, can you read verses 64 to 68 just to see just how the relationship with God has broken down and just how seriously it's broken down. So you've seen quite a lot of it in the first Pete's read for us, but these last five I think are even more shocking.
And the Lord will scatter you among all peoples from one end of the earth to the other, and there you shall serve other gods of wood and stone, which neither you nor your fathers have known. And among these nations you shall find no respite, and there shall be no resting place for the sole of your foot. But the Lord will give you there a trembling heart and failing eyes and a languishing soul. Your life shall hang in doubt before you. Night and day you shall be in dread and have no assurance of your life. In the morning you shall say, if only it were evening. And at evening you shall say, if only it were morning. Because of the dread that your heart shall feel and the sights that your eyes shall see. And the Lord will bring you back in ships to Egypt, a journey that I promised that you should never make again. And there you shall offer yourselves for sale to your enemies as male and female slaves, but there will be no buyer.
Thank you. So I think it's astonishing. God actually says, if you disobey, I will make you worship other gods. He will drive them away. He wants to have nothing more to do with them. He rescued them out of Egypt, but he'll send them back to Egypt. It'll be even worse than it was previously, because they won't even be honored slaves, or sort of honored slaves, but slaves with some sort of home and food. No one will even want them as that. So can you see that if they obey, they get all those blessings. If they disobey, they get the curses, and they're in exactly the same categories. The relationship with God, instead of being improved, goes worse. Their worship gods of stone and wood. And the land they're getting, Canaan, they're going to be taken out of. They're going to be cursed with extraordinary afflictions. Instead of descendants, they'll all be killed off. So it's exactly the same categories. We're not moving into a different dimension. It's not something random. It's exactly what God is talking about all the way through. It's going to be even worse than they were at the bottom of Egypt, if they disobey. So if disobey, it all goes horribly, horribly wrong. So we said when we hit the Abrahamic covenant, sin really wasn't a big deal. Now it's a huge deal. It's the heart of the Mosaic covenant. You've got to not sin in order for all these blessings to come. It'll be even worse in all these areas if you don't. Let's just think about that for a second, because that's quite important. The reason for the fact that sin is now brought in, conditions are now brought in, is that now that God is beginning to fulfill the promises, actually act, he says the cause of the fall must be dealt with first. And the cause must be dealt with by Israel obeying God. So when God didn't mention sin at that point, it wasn't an omission, it just he hadn't got there yet. Now he has got there, it has to be dealt with. As you think about the Bible plot as a whole, the way it's working is there are two dimensions to the problem. There's the cause, sin, and the results, the effects of that, God's punishment. As God begins to put it right, both of those are in play. At the flood, God doesn't promise to do anything about either. He just basically gives Noah a new start, slightly like Adam and Eve the first day they were thrown out of the Garden of Eden. It's a fresh start, clean world, one righteous man, have another go, but I, God, am not involved. It basically is what it is the day after he walks out of that. All that God promises is not to destroy again, in the same way. And nothing happens. Tower of Babel, they're still just as bad. Now, what God is doing at this point in the plot is he said, I will take responsibility for half the problem. All the curses I brought on you at the fall, I will do something, even if only partial, about putting right. But the sin side, that caused it all in the first place, that's still your responsibility. You have to obey. Does that make sense? And the question now is, we've discovered after the flood that God doing nothing doesn't work. If God takes responsibility for half of it, all the curse side, the results side, but leaves man the responsibility of half of it, the obey side, will that work? That's where we are in the plot. Does it make sense as a plot? And can you see, again, just so you understand, this is one reason why working forward will help you, because human beings, we always think we can do it all. And a big part of what the story is doing as you work forward is realizing how little we can do. God sort of step by step says, well, have a go at just doing this. If I do nothing, can you do it? Nope. If I do some of it, can you do it? And the answer fairly obviously is going to be no. Any questions? Let me say 5 more minutes worth and then throw it open for some more questions, because I can guess what one of the questions is going to be and I think I'm about to answer it. Fairly obviously, Israel does not obey those conditions. She sins very quickly. So even before Moses has finished revealing the covenant, you get the golden calf, which we all study. And so because of Israel's sin, the curses of the covenant kick into play, not the promises. God could, under the terms of the Mosaic covenant, immediately destroy them. And that's what he threatens to do at the golden calf. Moses intercedes. God doesn't destroy, partly because he's merciful, partly because he's got some crucial lessons he's trying to teach. That's why he's revealing the Mosaic covenant, and he can't do that if Israel is immediately destroyed. But God can't just ignore Israel's sin, so he institutes the sacrificial system where a sacrifice dies instead of Israel. God still punishes Israel, but he doesn't destroy them. And the sacrificial system is a crucial part of the Mosaic covenant, but it doesn't fully deal with sin. So we see right up front that the Mosaic covenant is not the way that God will fulfill his promises to Abraham. It's not going to work because Israel sins, and you get that right up front. And this, I suspect, is the question that's going through everybody's mind. So is the Mosaic covenant a mistake? It can't be a mistake. How is that working? The way I've set it up makes it sound like it's a complete mistake. It is not a mistake. It is not a bad thing. It is not the way that God will reverse the fall. It is not the way Israel will inherit the promises. And God knows that. And Moses knows that. And one of the reasons why we're choosing Deuteronomy 28 and Leviticus 26 is because it's clearer there that God knows that. So when we do Deuteronomy 28, we'll do with it a chunk of Deuteronomy 31, which comes just afterwards. So let's have a look at that. Deuteronomy 31, verses 14 to 18.
And the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, the days approach when you must die. Call Joshua to present yourselves in the tent of meeting, that I may commission him." And Moses and Joshua went and presented themselves in the tent of meeting. And the Lord appeared in the tent in a pillar of cloud, and the pillar of cloud stood over the entrance of the tent. And the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, you are about to lie down with your fathers. Then this people will rise and whore after the foreign gods among them in the land that they are entering, and they will forsake me and break my covenant that I have made with them. Then my anger will be kindled against them in that day, and I will forsake them and hide my face from them, and they will be devoured. And many evils and troubles will come upon them, so that they will say in that day, 'Have not these evils come upon us because our God is not among us?' And I will surely hide my face in that day because of all the evil that they have done, because they have turned to other gods."
Thank you. So if you just had Leviticus 26 or Deuteronomy 28, you think, okay, could get blessings, could get curses. Who knows? Maybe God doesn't know. Moses doesn't know. No one knows. But actually, Deuteronomy 31 tells you right there and then, God knows perfectly well. And Moses knows perfectly well that's what's going to happen, the curses. So why does God give that covenant? If he knows it's not going to work, and Moses, his servant, knows it's not going to work, why give that covenant? Why spend four books of the Bible giving that covenant? Why does it become such a big thing? And the answer is, God is using it to teach us. One of the things, just digression I'll come back to, the whole point of the Old Testament is to teach. So Jesus is the one through whom everything happens in the New Testament. Why doesn't God send Jesus in Genesis 4? Because we wouldn't understand Jesus. The whole Old Testament is there so that when Jesus comes, we understand him. It doesn't actually achieve anything, the Old Testament. If you think about God's great salvation plan in getting us to heaven, the Old Testament doesn't achieve anything. All it does is reveal and teach. So we understand it when the actual achievement starts happening. If you like, the Old Testament is to the New what Abram is to Moses. It reveals and teaches, but doesn't achieve. Then Moses comes and achievement starts. The whole Old Testament reveals, but doesn't achieve. Jesus comes and achievement begins, as we'll see. Does that make sense? So what's being taught in the Mosaic Covenant? Well, first of all, what's being taught is that the cause of the fall must be dealt with. Sin has to be dealt with before God can fulfill his promises. Secondly, it teaches us that Israel is incapable of dealing with the fall herself. Right from the golden calf and consistently all the way through the Old Testament, she doesn't obey. She cannot do it. So God's going to have to do something on that side as well. Thirdly, it teaches us that a sacrifice can make a real difference in turning away God's wrath, which obviously begins to show us how God will actually, in the end, deal with it through a perfect sacrifice. And fourthly, it teaches us a huge amount about God himself, the fact he's a merciful God, the fact his desire is to dwell with his people, the fact he's a powerful God. All sorts of things are taught about God. So the Mosaic Covenant is a massive, massive teaching tool, but it doesn't actually achieve anything. And it doesn't contradict the Abrahamic, I suspect this is a question going through Ali's mind, it doesn't contradict the Abrahamic covenant, because if Israel did obey the Mosaic Covenant, she would get the promises to Abraham. If she doesn't, she won't, but those promises still stand. So when we get to the New Testament, we all know that we are heirs of the Abrahamic covenant. That runs all the way through the New Testament. We are heirs of the Abrahamic covenant. Not Israel, because Israel didn't obey. Now, it's more complicated, but that's the most basic. So Israel could have been the heirs if she'd obeyed. She doesn't, so she isn't. But they will still be heirs. God will still fulfill that promise. It'll just be a different way and to a different people. Does that make sense? Now, that's all I'm going to say before a loop break, so let me throw it open now for slightly more serious question time, when your brain has a chance to catch up with me rabbiting on.
I find it really helpful to do the whole, this is the fall, this is the new creation. In the Bible studies this year, that doesn't really happen, does it? You just start Genesis in the fall,
yeah,
and you don't do the end point.
When we do the Genesis 1 to 3, I'm not sure quite what the student team are doing with their manual, because you've got using a slightly different manual to the workers. In the workers, the study is officially Genesis 1 to 3, but the last third of the study, we do look ahead to Revelation 21, 22.
Okay.
Do you do that as well in yours? You probably don't know. Mary, I think that most of the work...
Mary will know better, because she actually tweets at least.
But there's nothing to stop you putting a sneak preview in of Revelation 21, 22.
That's really helpful. Think actually, and then you shift what's in the middle as you go on,
yeah,
rather than we're just kind of fumbling around.
Yes,
where
you go, yeah.
Which I think I did find that. I'm not sure if I don't like it, but I think it would be helpful to think about actually, can you do that?
Mm.
You can definitely put it in. I think there are briefings in the thing which I think may put it in as well.
Yeah.
But I think the answer is, it may well be that your leaders actually put it in as well, but what happens is, because it tends to be in the first study of the year, even if it's there, by study 7 or 8, people have forgotten about it.
Yeah.
So what you need to... This is why, as leaders, you need to be so clear what you're trying to achieve, which is the big plot. So even when you're in the middle of Exodus, and there's no explicit mention of Revelation and the end point, as leaders, it's worth just reminding people, remember, that's where we're heading.
Then also not being, oh, that reminds me of Jesus.
That's right.
All the time. So it's that balance, the tension of those two things, both looking forward,
but then
not to making links before they're made by the Bible itself.
Precisely. Ali?
Sorry, you just said what was
it? I think the answer is, keep Revelation 21, 22 in mind, but not the rest of the New Testament. So there's a lot of New Testament, and that's the bit which will confuse. That is sort of the minimum that you need to remember, and if that's just one little thing, and they can hold that.
That's very helpful.
Any other questions?
With, say, some of the complexities of teaching the Mosaic Covenant, just to clarify, so obviously you've explained some of the more complicated things about some of the questions there. How do we kind of still focus on the main thing, keep the simple storyline of the Bible, but also answer people's kind of, but wait a minute, what about this?
Do we try and do
that outside of studies, do you think?
I don't know where students are these days, how many of them will even be aware there's a problem there, or if you just don't raise the hornet's nest, the dog will lie, to mix my metaphors. I suspect in most of the groups, if you don't mention anything about it, they'll just not spot it at all. If they do spot it, I also think it's worth getting your groups on side with what you're doing. So if you explain to them why, as I've tried to do with you, why you're staying with a simple, and there is a lot more happening, and you're not trying to cover everything, you're just trying to get the simple and why, they will hopefully play ball with you. Because I think most people who come to an RML study want it to work. The reason you come to an RML study as opposed to a fun Hillsong, let's go to the nightclub together sort of event, is because you want to study God's word.
That's not going online.
Sorry, you better make sure Monty edits that. They want it to succeed. If you tell them, sorry, but very often they don't give that impression because they don't know what success is. So if you tell them what you're trying to do, I think they're much more likely to work with you to that end.
Yeah. Is it worth then doing things like sort of, particularly on kind of the don't get to Jesus too early?
Yes.
Or kind of have you're not allowed to mention. You're not allowed, you know.
But explain why. So if they don't explain why and it's just a prohibition,
so
it just frustrates.
I referring to a student. And we used to, my flatmate and I used to go home and we weren't allowed to mention Jesus this week. Like, we were really, I think we probably had listened very carefully at the start of the year and they probably didn't say it.
Yeah.
But we did get annoyed and we didn't quite understand it.
But again, remember, just because Hugh Palmer, when he was working at St. Helens, used to say that the first time somebody hears something, they don't hear it, just goes straight over them. The second time they hear it, they think, heard that before somewhere. And it's only about the third time they hear it that they connect with it.
I was just on the is there going to be an issue when we come to the Mosaic Covenant?
I wonder if it's worth dealing with it very simply and flagging it up, just because otherwise you're going to get all the way through to the end of the year and do Galatians, Hebrews stuff, and they're then going to, if it does come up then, it's going to, they're going to get knots.
Yeah.
Whereas at least if you've said right from the beginning, this wasn't a mistake, this is what God's doing with it, when you get to that point, it's going to be much easier.
Yeah, so I think at the level that I've done it, it may just be worth mentioning it. Yeah, I agree with that. So we are going to explicitly look at Deuteronomy 31. That's the study is Deuteronomy 28 and 31 for precisely that reason. So we're told up front, right up front, we know it's not going to work and God knows it. It's not a mistake.
Okay.
So that's the main reason for the shift from Leviticus to Deuteronomy, so we can get Deuteronomy 31 in as part of that package study.
Will you say something at some point about prep and helping group members do prep? I know that last year we had issues with prep. That's
That
is. It's a slightly different context. It's an IGG context, not having it in the correct language context, but also supporting it in a helpful way. And what to say at the start of the year, so this prep gets a good start.
Yeah. I'm not personally involved with student night, but I think that is so important. I'm doing the workers' night, and that is my intention. I'm going to almost go in with a whole sort of, let's raise the bar. Say to them right up front, day one, this is year three of RML, we're going to raise the bar massively. It's all a case of expectation management. If they start off thinking this is the same as RML 1 and 2, they won't do any prep. But if you basically say to them, look, it's a much bigger exercise, it's much more exciting, but you need to raise your game to match it, and raising the game means prep, then I still don't think it'll work with everybody, but it may work with enough. And once, if you can create some sort of momentum and enough of the group are beginning to do the prep, others will jump on board.
Yeah.
And I think it's really, prep is absolutely essential. You cannot do the overview without prep. You don't have time to read the passage. Don't even try. Just tell them, week one, we're not even going to read the passage. You have to do your prep. Run the study for the people who have done the prep.
Yeah.
The people who haven't done the prep, throw overboard. And what will happen is they'll jump back on board when they realize that they're not being pandered to.
The other thing, I think, last year in Britain, quite a few people didn't have a manual until a few weeks in.
Yeah, I don't know. It's only, we had a,
I
think it was partly a language issue and expectations and work expectations and things. But coming to a study and being like, what's a gazelle, is just not helpful. Because we had to look at, you know, like, it's like, it's a prancing animal, but like, you need to
that's
like,
not really
beforehand. Like, that's not
the line that's sticking in my head.
Yeah.
And that's before you get to the, who are the Nephilim?
Yeah.
But so I think one thing which practically you want to do is the first night, ideally maybe at the welcome party, we're going to say come along and get the manual.
And pay for it and do the prep, to be honest.
And if anyone's got a problem, pay for it, like, we'll pay for it.
Yeah.
You're having one.
Yeah.
And certainly with third year, because you know them, what I'm proposing to do with our certainly leaders before they get the manual is we're going to email out the relevant pages from the manual to all of them. And to say, even if you haven't got the manual, even if you didn't turn up, even if you haven't paid for it, here is the prep for the first study. And it, the fact you've taken the trouble to email all of them hopefully will say, this matters, that's why we've bothered. Any other questions? So that we need to have a break because we've only done 5 books out of 66. And we've spent an hour and a quarter already, hour and a half already. Any other questions just on the content? Let's take a quick loo break. Can we start again just after 11? If we have a chance to fix the board properly, that would be nice.
I did mention it to Helen earlier,
right. We have done a third, and we are running well behind schedule. I hope we'll finish in time for lunch. But I suspect it won't be an early lunch. Good. So, any questions at this point? Haven't had a break to clarify the mind. Everybody happy with what we've done so far? Good. I'm just going to plow on then, and I suspect the questions will multiply as we go on and we begin to see how the bits come together. So I won't labour the questions at this point. We'll just keep going without, as though the break hadn't happened. So what we're now doing is we're now under two covenants, the Abrahamic covenant and the Mosaic covenant. And a lot of the rest of the Bible, certainly the Old Testament, is about what happens as a result of Israel being under those two covenants. The first 250 years of the Mosaic covenant is what we're going to look at now. Because of Israel's sin at and immediately after Mount Sinai, God condemns that generation to die in the desert. And as we all know from Sunday school, they wander around the desert for 40 years. Joshua then leads Israel into Canaan. And initially, things look pretty good. So when you look at the book of Joshua, things look very good, and it looks like they're winning the land, and everything's going hunky-dory. But Israel keeps sinning, and so it doesn't last, and they don't inherit the promises. Instead, Israel only inherits some of the land. She has no peace and few blessings, and God is pretty hostile. It really does look like the curses of the Mosaic covenant are kicking into play. Pete, can you read Judges 2, verses 10 to 15, please?
Judges 2, 10 to 15. And all that generation also gathered to their fathers, and there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord or the work that he had done for Israel. And the people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. And they abandoned the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them up out of the land of Egypt. They went after other gods from among the gods of the peoples who were around them and bowed down to them. And they provoked the Lord to anger. They abandoned the Lord and served the Baals and the Ashtaroth. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he gave them over to plunderers who plundered them. And he sold them into the hand of their surrounding enemies, so that they could no longer withstand their enemies. Whenever they marched out, the hand of the Lord was against them for harm, as the Lord had warned, and as the Lord had sworn to them. And they were in terrible distress.
Thank you. So you can see God is really pretty hostile, and he's against them instead of for them. He's not giving them blessings, he's not giving them peace, he's giving them enemies and hardship, and they only have some of the land. And that goes on for about 200 years. That I won't just yet. The big problem is sin. Why is it happening? Because they're not obeying the terms of the Mosaic Covenant. They're not even beginning to. They're worshipping other gods. And until sin is dealt with, Israel will not inherit all God has promised. But one of the lessons we learn, so each part of the story is teaching you something and moving the plot forward. What happened in the Mosaic Covenant, as well as all we saw, as I mentioned very briefly, is you see a sacrifice can help. One of the things that you're learning in this next phase of the Bible story is a good leader can help. How did they get out of Egypt and into the land in the first place? It was Moses and then Joshua. It was because of them, and really only because of them, that Israel got as far as the land. In the first 200 years in the land, in the period summed up in Judges, whenever Israel repents of her sins, God's solution is to raise up a judge, a leader who helps the people, and he helps. The problem is those leaders all die. But what we have is that the story goes as follows. They're out there, things looking good, and then they sin at the golden calf and in the desert, and things go horribly wrong. And then Joshua comes along, and things get wonderfully better, and they get the land, and then they sin when he dies. And then God raises up a judge, and things get better, and it just goes on like that. But the trend in Judges, most of us know, is downwards, and things are gradually drifting downwards through the book of Judges. Ali?
Quick question on that one. Are you saying you learn that a good leader helps to deal with sin or deals with the effects of sin?
At this point, is mainly, thank you, good question. I'm mainly dealing with the effect. The point of a judge is that the judge helps make sure that people do right. So if you like, they repent, and the judge comes and conquers enemies, but also, to some extent, helps people keep the law. So it's a bit of both, but repentance is what triggers God raising up a judge. But that's a good question.
Because the judge is known as, even when the judges die, the period of peace before it all goes partially.
That's right.
At the end of the period of peace becomes
thank you. And it's because the judge has, if like, reintroduced the rule of God's law and brought people back to that. But the problem is that these leaders, these all die. Moses dies, Joshua dies, judges all die. What's the answer to your leader dying? Well, the answer is, if you have something like a monarchy, where when a leader dies, the monarchy doesn't die, their son takes over, maybe that's a help, because there'll always be a leader. And Judges finishes by implying that a king might actually help. Pete, can you read Judges 21:25? This verse turns up four times in the last four chapters. It's almost a refrain. But we'll just look at the last instance.
21:25. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes.
Okay, so the implication isn't here that the king defeats the enemies, but if only they had a king, it wouldn't be the case that everybody did what was right in their own eyes. They would be kept to the rule of law, which hopefully would be God's law. And so the next big step forward in God's plan is the monarchy. The first king, Saul, is not a success. But under David and Solomon, the next two kings, Israel reaches the high point of her time. Under David, Israel for the first time occupies the whole of the land that God promises back to Abraham in the first place, and then again at Moses. And she enjoys peace with all her neighbors because David defeats all of them because he's a very good warlord king. Under Solomon, she becomes amazingly prosperous, and God's temple, which symbolizes God dwelling with Israel, is built. So let's just have a quick look at that. In 1 Kings, let's have a look at a few verses just to see how good life is. So 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 20 and 21. Everybody in 1 Kings 4?
20 and 21. Judah and Israel were as many as the sand by the sea. They ate and drank and were happy. Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the Euphrates to the land of the Philistines and to the border of Egypt. They brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. Solomon's provision for one day was 30 cores of fine flour. Oh no, I read too far.
You've read too far, just up to 21. Thank you. So there you get the idea of there are lots of them, they've got peace, they've got prosperity, everybody's happy, they're all content. Can you read verse 25, please?
And Judah and Israel lived in safety from Dan even to Beersheba, every man under his vine and under his fig tree, all the days of Solomon.
Thank you. So real sort of contentment, blessing in the land, all is good. And can you read chapter 8, verses 10 to 11, please? 8, 10 to 11.
And when the priests came out of the holy place, a cloud filled the house of the Lord, so that the priests could not stand to minister because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the house of the Lord.
Thank you. So what have you got now? You've got God dwelling in his people in a permanent building. There's no sort of moving around the desert. He's now permanent in this permanent building in the temple. They've got the whole land. They've got peace. They've got prosperity. It looks like they've got everything promised to Abraham. It really is pretty good. So in the time of the monarchy, that's not meant to go backwards in time. Things get really quite good indeed. And the whole point of that is to show how much a good leader can help, a good king can help. But the problem is the monarchy doesn't mean a good leader. It means there always is a leader, but he's not always good. And even the good ones still sin as well as die. And when they die, they're replaced by bad ones. So even David, the best of them all, sins, most notoriously with Bathsheba. And because of his sin, Israel is plagued by civil war. Solomon sins even more by marrying non-Israelite women and who lead him into idolatry. And all sorts of bad things happen, as we'll see in a moment, because of that. But nevertheless, the king is the way forward. And so God makes the third of his great covenants now with David. And he promises this and more. So let's have a look at the Davidic covenant. God promises David that his descendant will enable Israel to inherit all that God promised Abraham. Let's go to 2 Samuel chapter 7. Pete, can you read verses 10 to 13, please?
And I will appoint a place for my people Israel, and will plant them so that they may dwell in their own place, and be disturbed no more, and violent men shall afflict them no more as formerly, from the time that I appointed judges over my people Israel. And I will give you rest from all your enemies. Moreover, the Lord declares to you that the Lord will make you a house. When your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your fathers, I will raise up your offspring after you, who shall come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. Sorry, how far are we?
2:13.
2:13, sorry. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever.
Thank you. So, what will this descendant do? He will build God a house, verses 12 and 13, which will enable God to dwell with Israel, which the Mosaic Covenant said was the heart of the promised relationship with God. He will be able to give Israel peace, and God will give her a home, implying that there'll be a kingdom, which implies land. You don't have a home and a kingdom without land. Lots of descendants. You don't get a kingdom without lots of descendants. And blessing. It's a home, it's peace. And the descendant will reign forever, ensuring that Israel has all that God has promised permanently. What God is promising David, therefore, is everything promised to Abraham and all the good things promised in the Mosaic Covenant, and there are no conditions. It's very important to say there are no conditions. Even if he disobeys, God won't take his love away. And that's particularly important because Israel isn't inheriting what happens because of her, what God has promised, because of her sin. So what I haven't put on is all the way through there, why is all this happening? The answer is sin. Why is that happening? Sin. But what God is saying is, you get a promise to David, which doesn't have an equivalent, what happens if you don't? It's just, I will unconditionally commit myself to doing the good thing again. So this, we don't know quite how the sin thing is going to be dealt with, implicitly because it's a leader, but not explicit. But implicitly, it's been set up that a leader will help, and you now see that. But it won't be a problem. You will get those promises, those good things.
But then why, from David or from Solomon,
hold fire. Good question. Don't lose these questions, but hold fire. We'll get there. But that's exactly the sort of thing you need to hold in mind, because that's what you're trying to see. You're trying to see the plot develop. Why is it the promise is made, but it's all ripped apart? Why is it? How do the Abrahamic, the Mosaic, and the Davidic fit together? It's that holding together which the overview is all about. It's just making sure it all fits. And as I've said, you cannot repeat it too often. You can add so much more detail, but actually it's much better to see the simple thing clearly, that it does hold together. The new thing that happens in David, which is why it's an improvement, is you actually see it's going to happen through a king from David's line. And this king will rule over God's people forever. And it is this strand that leads to Jesus on the throne in the new creation. So let's put this up. This is very, very sticky blue tack. Someone's obviously been massaging it a lot. Oops, wrong one. That goes too far. You hold it for later. Where's my David? Splendid. Bye, game. You don't have too many of the answers at this stage. So you can see that I've left one out, Moses. There was another one on Moses, but never mind, you can see it there. So when Moses comes in, the sin role begins to be filled up. It goes on. With David, the King Jesus role comes. So you can see that as you go through the covenants, extra elements are being set up each time round. So with Abraham, it's just the effects. With Moses, it's the cause as well as effects. With David, it's Jesus who's going to help solve everything. Each one is adding a new component into the basic plot. Will get us to the new creation, where basically all the main categories have now been introduced. Sorry?
We've started mentioning.
Yes, yes.
Can you say why?
Yes, because this is the time that Jesus begins to be put on. So when you come to Jesus, where in the Old Testament are we told constantly he fulfills? You get one or two references, I think only one, to him being Isaac, the son of Abraham. So it's not there, but it's just not a big thing in the New Testament. I think you get one or two references to him being a prophet, which gets mentioned in Moses, but it's not a big thing. But you get literally scores of reference to him being David's son. That's the big thing that he fulfills. So we're basically not, we are mentioning him in, still not too much, but because the big thing that he fulfills is now on the table, we're cutting with a simple big line of the Bible story to begin to mention him here. Does that make sense? So you can see how you could have mentioned him with Isaac, you could have mentioned him with the prophet and the Mosaic Covenant and Moses as a type of him, etc., etc. But that's the next layer, or two or three layers down in terms of extra complexity and nuance. Whereas when you mention him as David's son, that is the primary line, which is just simplest, clearest. So it's not too confusing. But we're still just saying this is the line that leads to him. We're not saying look at all the nuances and this is how he does it and this is how he's like David and this is how he isn't. Keep it simple. Any other questions at this stage?
I
think he was pointing at you. Oh. Yes.
So they get a king, and that seems to be something that we're saying here is a good thing. But I wonder, isn't when the people asked for a king, isn't that
God says?
It doesn't God say
God's
bad. Kings are bad. Brilliant. Kings aren't actually going to be great for you.
Brilliant. And that is, sorry, this is. We'll digress into this, but this is the sort of detail which is really interesting, and it's, I love it, but will distract from the main plot. So you know by the time you reach 1 Samuel 8 that a king is a good thing. It's been set up multiple times as a good thing. From Genesis, a king is a good thing. It's there in the Pentateuch in places we haven't looked at in Numbers and things like that, but there will be a king and it's a good thing. You see it in Deuteronomy that you're allowed to have a king and it's fine. You see in Judges it's a good thing. So why isn't it a good thing in Samuel? That's almost the only place you're told it's not a good thing.
Also, isn't it a bad thing because it's only a bad thing because they've rejected God from being their king, and it's about a man king is the bad thing.
Well, it's not so much a man king, it's the timing which is the bad thing. So Saul, the first king Saul, is not a good king, and it seems to be partly a timing thing. So they say to Samuel, you're about to die, you're a good leader, we want a leader, give us Saul. Actually, Samuel doesn't die before David is in a position to be king. And the whole point of the book seems to be patience. So what is Saul's great sin? It is he's impatient and will not wait. He sacrifices rather than waiting for Samuel to turn up. What is David's great virtue? He's willing to wait for king. He knows he's been anointed but doesn't grab it. He will wait until God brings it about. So the whole thing seems to be timing at that point, which is the big difference between Saul and David. Israel's sin seems to me not so much they want a king, but they want it now. Yeah. And it's bad under those terms. They get the wrong one.
And then they also choose Saul.
Well, yes and no. God also appoints Saul, doesn't he? So, but that's the sort of thing where you can go into much more detail, and I'd say do your very best to avoid it. Just that one study when you do that study. Sorry?
But the overarching principle, the overarching thing of Kings is that they are a good thing.
Brilliant.
It's just in that particular...
That's right.
Just because it's true there doesn't mean it's true. No Bible kind of thing.
Exactly.
So yeah,
keep
so
the
king,
big thing clear.
King on God's terms.
Yes. God's king on God's terms is good. Any other king on any other terms is not. Yeah.
Have I got time for two more questions?
Very briefly.
So, secondly, isn't the idea of a king is that they keep the people from sin?
Yes.
In a new creation, there is no sin, so why do you need a king?
I suppose it's the other way around. Why is there no sin in the new creation?
Because there is a king.
Because they, well, for a number of reasons, but one of them is there is a king.
Okay. And third question. So when we see fulfillment, so in the new creation is obviously the fulfillment of these promises, in a sense, are we actually saying that, so their fulfillment of the Abrahamic and the Davidic covenants, but actually because the Mosaic covenant's an if covenant, actually that's not actually ever fulfilled, because, well...
What, the Mosaic covenant?
Yeah, because actually the people never do that.
Yeah.
And so actually, in essence, yes, you see fulfillment of the Abrahamic and the Davidic covenant, but it's... The Mosaic covenant, actually, you don't ever really see fulfillment of.
Yes,
it.
Yes. Well, this again is one of those places where you get multiple levels and layers and where the story is incredibly rich. What happens with the Mosaic covenant, you can take in two different ways, and the Bible teaches both. So one way the Bible teaches the Mosaic covenant is no one fulfills the Mosaic covenant except Jesus. He does obey. He inherits by right, and we all inherit in him. And that is true and legitimate. But the bigger line, and probably, if you like, again, the primary line is, and the one we will focus on in the overview, is when Jesus comes, he replaces the Mosaic covenant, which we'll see when we get to, later on this morning in Hebrews, you get a new covenant which replaces the Mosaic covenant. The Mosaic covenant was just there for a time. And that seems to be the primary line. So when you look at the terms of the Mosaic covenant in Deuteronomy 28, it is. If you obey, you get those. If you disobey, you get those. If you disobey and you get those, that's it. It comes to an end. The covenant has reached its terminus. So when you've got either that or that, the covenant reaches its end, concludes. You get that, you've broken the covenant, you've got all the curses, God is no longer with you on those terms, fini. And if for anything to go on beyond that, God has to re-promise, which he does in the Davidic and the New Covenants. And as I said, that's not the only line in the Bibles, but that's probably the primary line in the Bible. And therefore, that's the one you put on first. And then when you've got that in place, you can say, ah, yes, but there's also another dimension. Jesus actually does fulfill it, and isn't it exciting to see that? But trying to put all of it in will confuse.
And they're not necessarily, they're usually enforcing, aren't they? So... Jesus fulfills the Mosaic covenant, which had ended for the people.
Yeah.
So it narrows all the way down to
remnant, yeah.
Then smaller remnant. Jesus fulfills it, end, in both ways.
Yeah.
And then replaces it with
the
new.
So they're not mutually exclusive at all. They're not incompatible. But so again, it's just the only reason for leaving it out is simplicity. Keep it simple. I think you really need to write above your prep every week. Not simplistic. Getting that balance right is important. Get a feel for your group, where they are. But making sure that it's simple enough that they're getting the big plot is paramount. If you miss that, if you lose that, you've lost everything. Even if you get lots of lovely detail, you've lost the big thing.
Yeah. These weren't necessarily questions to be teaching.
People happy? Any other questions? Good. Let's press on. So, the question still is, so is Israel is now under three covenants, Abraham, Moses, and David. Because even though there's a covenant with David, the Mosaic hasn't yet been terminated. It hasn't yet been either fulfilled or superseded. So they're under three covenants. What happens under those three covenants? The Davidic covenant, like the Abrahamic is a promise for the future. Israel's experience under her kings at this time is far from this. So David and Solomon both sin. Their successors sin even more, many very, very badly. And the books of 1 and 2 Kings basically traces all Israel's kings, Israel and Judah, and shows us that none of them is the one promised. We're constantly disappointed. Instead of that, because of Israel's sin, God punishes Israel. And over the next 350 years, we have three great disasters. So the decline and fall of Israel isn't a gradual thing. It happens in three great cataclysms. First of all, immediately after the reign of Solomon, because of his sin with all his wives, the kingdom splits. So if you like, that's monarchy. That is the split of the kingdom. And we are now close enough to us in time that we can begin to put some definite dates on. At this point here, we're slightly guessing as to the dates. We have some clues, but lots of disagreement. The dates are now getting slightly firmer, so we'll put some on. That the split happens in 922 BC. Then that goes on for another 200 years. There's two kingdoms, north and south. And then because of sin, the southern kingdom gets exiled. I'll say Israel exiled.
North.
Thank you. Let's say. Right. And then, and that's in 722 BC, so exactly 200 years. And that goes on for 150 years, and then you get the exile of Judah. And that happens in 597-587, in two waves, which is why there's a difference in time. And you'll see some slight discrepancies on dates. It's 597 or 596. That's, I think, because it's a winter campaign, so it depends when you date the thing exactly. So three great tragedies, which bring, if you like, Judah and Israel to an end. And by the exile, God's temple is destroyed, Israel has lost her land, there's no blessing, many of the people have been killed, and Israel ceases to be a kingdom. So basically, I've drawn it at the same level as the curses of the Mosaic Covenant, because that is exactly what it is. It is the curses of the Mosaic Covenant which have come into play. Can you read 2 Kings 25, 8 to 11, please?
In the fifth month, on the seventh day of the month, that was the 19th year of King Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the bodyguard, a servant of the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem. And he burned the house of the Lord, and the king's house, and all the houses of Jerusalem. Every great house was burned down. And all the army of the Chaldeans, who were with the captain of the guard, broke down the walls round Jerusalem. And the rest of the people who were left in the city, and the deserters who had deserted to the king of Babylon, together with the rest of the multitude, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, carried into exile.
Thank you. So, temple destroyed, city destroyed, land lost, exiled. A lot of the people have been killed. It is. If the time of David and Solomon is the high point of Israel's life, it's never as good as it is there. The exile is the low point. It is never as bad as it is there. We've gone in 350 years from a zenith to nadir. But God's promises in the covenants are not fulfilled in Israel before the exile. Solomon is not the promised king, nor are any of others Israel's other kings. Can I say, again, there's parallels. So the Mosaic covenant, was the way that Abrahamic could have been fulfilled if only Israel had obeyed. She didn't obey, she didn't get it. Solomon is the one through whom the Davidic covenant could have been fulfilled if he'd obeyed. He didn't, so it turned out not to be. And none of his physical descendants either. So the more you understand of God's plan, the more you see there are patterns that repeat. A promise set up, fulfillment begins, but it doesn't happen because of sin. Promise made through Solomon, fulfillment begins, but it doesn't happen because of sin. So it's repeating, and you're beginning, it's just reinforcing the idea. Sin is the big problem. We have to solve it. We are in this mess because of sin. Why are we in exile here? Sin. Why has this dreadful disaster of the exile happened? Sin. Sin is a massive, massive problem. You cannot read the Old Testament running forward without realizing just how sin ruins everything. So we very often teach sinners, look at sin, the lives today. And people think, well, actually, we don't sin that badly and it hasn't messed things up that badly. But you read the story and you just cannot avoid the fact that sin has wrecked everything. However, even though the Mosaic Covenant, Solomon, are not the way that God is going to be fulfilling his promises, God's plan is still exactly on track. Nothing has gone awry from God's perspective. Things look bad, but God's promises to Abraham and David are unconditional, and he will fulfill them. And so into this situation, God speaks through the prophets and reveals that he will make yet another covenant, the final covenant he makes. Now, just something to underline, because I think it's something many of us don't realize. The exile and what God is saying at the time of the exile is crucial. For most of us, we don't know much about the exile, and we think, therefore, it's a relatively small thing, you know, which happens in half a book somewhere or other. God's revelation at and around the time of the exile accounts for half the Old Testament. It is massive. The trouble is, it's the half of the Old Testament we don't understand, like all the prophets. So, and a lot of the wisdom literature and stuff like that. Well, not, some of the wisdom literature, but lots of the history, lots of the prophets. It's all happening there. But God's, at this point, therefore, half of the Old Testament is revealed now. And let's spend a little bit of time looking at what he's saying. So, in pairs, again, let's look at what God is promising through the prophets compared to what he's promised Abraham and David. And there are three passages I want you to look at. Well, not two passages I want you to look at, basically, just to see that. Ezekiel 34, verses 25 to 30, and 37, verses 24 to 28. And your task is, look at those two passages. Don't cheat. The answers are, or what I think the answers are on the handout. Don't look at those. Look at the Bible. From those passages, what is being promised as it compares to these categories? Well, better those categories, the Davidic covenant, Abrahamic covenant categories. And we'll give you 5 minutes. How are people doing? Do we feel we've worked through all the categories, all the passages here?
Yeah. They won't accept the nations. They won't suffer the reproach of the nations. Yeah. They won't be prey to the nations.
Oh, I see. So verse 27.
Yeah. Good. Everybody there? Let's whiz through our categories and see what's happened to them. So I think, so what happens to God's relationship with his people?
Everlasting dwelling in Ezekiel 37.
Yes, can you read 37:27, please?
My dwelling place shall be with them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people.
So that's an almost exact repeat of exactly what was promised Abraham and Moses and David. I will be their God, that started with Abraham. My dwelling will be with them that began with Moses, repeated in David. So picked up exactly. And remember, that is stated when they're in exile. So things are as bad. The temple is burned. God has left. God has chucked them out. And God says, time will be. I will dwell with them and permanently, and I'll be their God. It's all
put back. The house of Israel as well.
Yeah. Brilliant. Yeah.
Which is different. And that being the promise that there will be a house for you.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a real sort of, the relationship is restored to it, even though it looks so bad. What about land?
In 34, you get a lot of stuff around land and safety and pastures, and it's almost as though you're going to have a land which is going to be really good, and then the curses of the land in Genesis 3 are reversed.
Brilliant. So it does look like you're going to get a land and it's good land, and many of the problems of Genesis 3 aren't really there. Fair. Look, the Genesis 3 one is implicit, but it's, implicit. It is there how clear it is that it's actually a full reversal, not so much, but it's definitely a hint of there. The verse I've got done is 37:25. Pete, can you give us that one? But the 34 one is good as well.
They shall dwell in the land that I gave to my servant Jacob, where your fathers lived. They and their children and their children's children shall dwell there forever, and David my servant shall be their prince forever.
Thank you. So you're getting the land I promised you're going to get. But, and the reason why I didn't go with your 34 one, Jeff, is because they're clearer passages. What he's actually promising is that the land will be a new creation. So Pete, keeping a finger in Ezekiel, because we'll come back to it, can you go to Isaiah 65, verses 17-25? Yes, please.
For behold, I create new heavens and a new earth, and the former things shall not be remembered or come into mind. But be glad and rejoice forever in that which I create. For behold, I create Jerusalem to be a joy, and her people to be a gladness. I will rejoice in Jerusalem and be glad in my people. No more shall be heard in it the sound of weeping and the cry of distress. No more shall there be in it an infant who lives but a few days, or an old man who does not fill out his days. For the young man shall die 100 years old, and the sinner 100 years old shall be accursed. They shall build houses and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and eat their fruit. They shall not build and another inhabit. They shall not plant and another eat. For like the days of a tree shall be the days of my people be, and my chosen shall long enjoy the work of their hands. They shall not labour in vain, nor their children for calamity, for they shall be the offspring of the blessed of the Lord, and their descendants with them. Before they call, I will answer. While they are yet speaking, I will hear. The wolf and the lamb shall graze together, the lion shall eat straw like the ox, and dust shall be the serpent's food. They shall not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, says the Lord.
Thank you. So that's a tremendous passage, which actually says they're not just going to be given back the land. It's not that the animals won't defeat them, eat them like Ezekiel 34, maybe because all the animals have been killed off, slightly like we have done in most of the world these days. So lions tend not to kill too many people these days because there aren't many lions left to do the killing. But the whole creation will be made new. And lions will eat straw and lie down with the ox. They'll be there. They just won't eat animals or us. It is a wonderful new creation. There are promised blessings too, just as Abraham was promised blessings. Sorry, I should have asked you this question, but I've given you the answer, so keep going. Ezekiel 34, let's go back to that one. 34:26.
And I will make them and the places all around my hill a blessing. And I will send down the showers in their season. They shall be showers of blessing.
Thank you. So again, they'll be blessed, unlike what's happened throughout most of the last 600 years of history. when they've been cursed, God will shower blessings upon them. And the blessings will take the form of peace and prosperity, just as Moses and David were promised. What's happened to the death, large numbers, descendants idea? This time I will remember to ask you.
Again, isn't that still the one that's the least dealt with? Because what you've got again is children, so there are many of you, and chapter 37, your children's, so the kind of idea of generations will go on.
Brilliant.
But there's no suggestion, I know there is in Isaiah, but there's no suggestion here in Ezekiel that death itself is going to be.
Brilliant. So can you read 37:26, please?
I will make a covenant of peace with them. It shall be an everlasting covenant with them. And I will set them in their land and multiply them, and I'll set my sanctuary in their midst forevermore.
Thank you. So he'll multiply them. And as you said, Ali, in other verses, it'll keep going. There'll be lots of them. But again, Ezekiel isn't doing everything. So each book is doing its own different thing. Ezekiel, like when it came to the land, all Ezekiel promised was effectively restoration of the status quo before they went into exile. But Isaiah takes it further. When it comes to descendants, Ezekiel is promising a restoration of the status quo. Ezekiel, earlier on in the book, says lots of people will be killed at the exile. Great, terrible predictions in chapters 8 to 10 of death and destruction. Now you get restoration in people. But in Isaiah, as Ali said, it goes further. Pete, can you read Isaiah 25:7-8, please?
And he will swallow up on this mountain the covering that is cast over all peoples, the veil that is spread over all nations. He will swallow up death forever. And the Lord God will wipe away tears from all faces, and the reproach of his people he will take away from all the earth. For the Lord has spoken.
Thank you. So he'll take away death. And can you read 26:19, please?
Your dead shall live, their bodies shall rise. You who dwell in the dust, awake and sing for joy. For your dew is a dew of light, and the earth will give birth to the dead.
They will actually be resurrected. It's really quite striking. So at the exile, what you've got is you're getting promises at this time. Even as things go horribly wrong, you're getting promises of a full restoration of everything that went wrong at Eden. Actually, I should take that down because it isn't quite that yet. This is the first mention anywhere in the Bible of a new creation, is Isaiah 65. Well, Isaiah. 65 is the first actual mention of new creation. 11 is the first reference to something which looks like a new creation. Isaiah is the very first time in the whole Bible that you get the idea that death will be defeated. It's the very first time in the Bible you get an explicit mention of resurrection. I say that. There are one or two psalms which are very hard to date, which also imply, but they're very hard to date. Whereas Isaiah you can date, and you get a clear mention, death defeated. So that's the point. It's at that point that you know that what God is planning is a full restoration. Before Abraham, all you had to look forward to was, at best, nothing was going to get worse like the flood again. After Abraham, what you got is God is going to do something, but it's pretty limited, and that's where it stays. It's at that point, around the time of the exile, that you get your first inkling that what God is actually promising is a full reversal of everything that was lost at the fall. So it's really quite a big deal, this massive step forward to full reversal, full restoration of everything that was lost. And why is it a full reversal? How can that happen? And by the way, these are unconditional promises. Why is it unconditional? Why will it happen? Answer, and I heard one or two pairs mumbling about this. Because God has committed himself to dealing with the problem of sin. So God will cleanse them from their sin, and he'll give them new hearts and his spirit. Can you read Ezekiel? I think you saw it in the passages you gave, but the clearer one is Ezekiel 36, verses 25-27. And I think all these are passages we'll be looking at. So Ezekiel 36, 25-27, please.
I will sprinkle clean water on you, and you shall be clean from all your uncleannesses. and from all your idols I will cleanse you. I will give you a new heart, and a new spirit I will put within you. And I will remove the heart of stone from your flesh and give you a heart of flesh. I will put my spirit within you and cause you to walk in my statutes and be careful to obey my rules.
Thank you. So God, if you like, if Isaiah is focusing on the recreation or the renewal of creation, the remaking of creation, new creation, no death, what Ezekiel is doing here is he's saying he's going to remake us so we have hearts of flesh which will obey. He'll put his spirit within us to transform us completely. Isaiah also deals with this because it's such a big deal that sin is dealt with, but from a different angle. Isaiah 53 verses 5 and 6. We know this passage really well, but let's have a look at it. Five and six, please.
But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace. And with his stripes we are healed. All we, like sheep, have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all.
Thank you. So, in different ways, God says he will definitely deal with the problem of sin. There are at least three different ways mentioned already. Ezekiel, he will wash away all our sins. Actually, the four. Ezekiel, he will wash away all our sins. Ezekiel, he will put a new heart in us and change us from within so we'll obey. He'll give us his spirit to do it. Isaiah, there'll be a sacrifice that will actually work and atone for sin, unlike all those animal sacrifices that didn't work. So dealing with sin is a really big deal. The Bible puts it in different ways so we really get it. They're not mutually exclusive. They complement. This is one which is worth bringing up the different elements just to say sin is such a big deal. Look at the different ways God says he's going to deal with it to make sure it really is properly dealt with. And they will have the everlasting king, Davidic king, who will be key to inheriting the promises. So can you go to Ezekiel 37, verse 25, please?
They shall dwell in the land that I gave to my servant Jacob, where your fathers lived. They and their children's children shall dwell there forever. And David, my servant, shall be their prince forever.
Good. So my servant David, basically his heir, descendant, will be their prince forever. But again, Isaiah pushes it further. Isaiah 9, verse 6, please. Again, we know this so well. Every Christmas we sing it, but we now see it in the Bible context.
For to us a child is born, and to us a son is given. And the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. 6-8. But the increase of his government and of peace there will be no end. On the throne of David and over his kingdom to establish it and to uphold it with justice and with righteousness from this time forth and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this.
Thank you. So what you're discovering at this point is that you're actually getting not just a king, but the king is going to be God himself. So let me just summarize what God has promised at this point. It seems quite sudden to us. A lot of big things are happening. And it seems quite sudden. It'll happen in about three studies. And you think, whoa, what happened there? But actually, if you think it's half the Old Testament, and it's just because it's quite a hard half, we've just selected and not spent too much time there, it gives you a bit more perspective on it. Three great, great things happen at the... Well, first of all, to say what you're getting is, first of all, he says everything that went wrong I'll put right, I'll promise again everything I've promised previously. But there are three big steps forward that happen. First of all, we get a full reversal of the fall. It's the first time that has happened, the first time you get things like new creation, death, resolve, massive, massive steps forward that actually says, we're talking about full reversal of the fall, not just here's a sticking plaster to mean life isn't too bad. Secondly, It's the first time that you get a really clear God will deal with the cause as well as the results. So remember we said that when we went to the Mosaic Covenant, God said, okay, I will do half the work. I'll deal with the results, the effects of the curse. If you will do your side and deal with and obey, unlike Adam and Eve. By the time we get to the exile, we see that doesn't work. They can't do it. They haven't obeyed. They have received the curses. It's not going to work. So at this point, God says, okay, I'll do both halves. I'll do everything. I will deal both with the sin and with the effects. And when that happens, you will definitely get it. And by the way, you're going to get vastly, vastly more. And the third thing you see, the third huge step, which I think basically means this really is the whole new creation promised, is that this king will be God himself. He will. So it's an astonishing statement to find in the middle of the Old Testament that a human being who is of the line of David will be mighty God, everlasting Father. I don't know quite what the Jews make of that, but what we're discovering is this Davidic king will be God himself, which is why when you get to Revelation 21, you find the Lamb can sit on the throne with God. If you're a good monotheist and you've followed the Old Testament, God is absolutely unique. There is no one like him in all the world. He made the world. He rules the world. Nothing is like him. That's been drilled into Israel for 600 years, 700 years, from the Mosaic Covenant right through to the exile. How come then when you get reach the end of the story that you find there's somebody on the throne with God? I mean, has God changed his mind? Has he contradicted himself? No, and the answer comes there, because the one who sits on the throne with God is God. Second person of the Trinity. Does that make sense? So that's why when you... Sorry?
No wonder they didn't get it.
No wonder they didn't get it. Exactly. You can understand why they didn't get it. But you understand why. When you get there and you discover Jesus is God, actually, if you read the story forward, you realize much more what a big deal it is. A, that he is God, when he couldn't have been, because God is the only God. And B, why it is now right and proper he sits on the throne with God, because he is God. That didn't come out of nowhere. And it's because he is God, we'll see later on, it's because he is God that he can do all these things to make this all happen. So how does, God says he will do it all. How does he do it all? He does it through Jesus, the king, who is God. So he does it, but through his son. Does that make sense? These are massive steps forward. And as I said, they appear a bit sudden to us, but 50% of the Old Testament is written here. This is really quite interesting. I don't think I'd realized it till I started doing the overview. By the exile, God has finished promising everything that he's promised. I don't think there's, from the end of the exile through to the end of the Bible, there is no new promise made that I'm aware of. So up to this point, it's all been promise, 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 promise. And in terms of actually getting any of what God has promised, by the exile, they're as far from it as they ever are in the whole Bible. So they get nothing, but they are promised everything. So again, this is where in the New Testament, if you haven't read the Old Testament, you don't understand it, because you haven't got all that revelation and promise. That's all in the Old Testament. And our problem is reading the New Testament, we don't have the understanding, because that comes in the Old Testament. And the problem the other way is we go to the Old Testament and think we've got implementation, when actually we haven't. That's waiting for the New Testament. So the whole of Israel in the Old Testament, everything we think of as Israel, you know, your Sunday school, what did you think of as Israel? Israel was a nation with Jerusalem as the capital and the temple there and the Davidic king ruling it, wasn't that? Isn't that the picture you have, classic Israel? That is a complete dead end. That ends in they've lost every single bit of that. So that achieves as little as the flood. The flood happened, you went back to where? This goes through all sorts of twists and turns, whereas that took 3 chapters, that takes about 800 pages, but you end up exactly where you were. Basically slaves in Egypt. But in all that process where nothing has been achieved, I feel like everything has been revealed. Any questions? Ali? Sorry, is that a question or no?
It's sort of following the question. But is it quite right to say everything's been revealed? Because the thing I thought, the thing that's really least clear from the exile prophets and revelation is how the Gentiles are involved. So there's promises that the nations will be blessed and the nations will come in, and you get prophecies of Egypt coming in and Assyria coming in, and but the idea that we are, that God is going to make his people more than just ethnic Israel plus the people who join them is a New Testament idea.
Again,
Jesus says about the temple being destroyed.
We have kept it simple, so I've ignored that strand, and we'll come. We the way we tell the story, we will come to that when we get to the New Testament. But you've been all been doing Romans. How many of you have done Romans this last year? One. But you did Romans last year, year before. If you think of Romans and Romans chapters 9-11, Paul's big point there is the Gentiles come in is not a new idea, guys. God said in the Old Testament, not all Israel is Israel. God said in the Old Testament, the Gentiles would come in. God said in the Old Testament, only a remnant of Israel will be left. So actually, all the way through the prophets, you actually get quite a lot on the Gentiles will come in. But just for simplicity, I've not picked that strand up.
But also
we'll pick that up later.
In the narrative. Sees Daniel's arrival last, then he then bows down to God.
Yeah.
So there's an element of at least some sort of
what you
foreshadowing, I think, of the fact that God is not just for.
You need, I think that's right, but you need to be careful. So all the way through the Old Testament, you get individuals who align themselves with God and his purpose, starting with Rahab. And going through all sorts of other people, Ruth and all sorts of others who sort of buy in. And that definitely happens. But what you get in the time of the prophets is promises that lots and lots of Gentiles will come in. So let's just give you one verse. This isn't really part of the plot. Again, keep it simple. Sometimes you just have to put things in later for simplicity. Isaiah 56. Pete, can you read Isaiah 56, verse 3 to 6, 7, please? No, 8. 3 to 8. Isaiah 56, 3 to 8.
Let not the foreigner who has joined himself to the Lord say, the Lord will surely separate me from his people. And let not the eunuch say, behold, I am a dry tree. For thus says the Lord, to the eunuchs who keep my Sabbaths, who choose the things that please me and hold fast my covenant, I will give in my house and within my walls a monument and a name better than sons and daughters. I will give them an everlasting name that shall not be cut off. And the foreigners who join themselves to the Lord to minister to him, to love the name of the Lord and to be his servants, everyone who keeps the Sabbath and does not profane it and hold fast my covenant, these I will bring to my holy mountain and make them joyful in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices will be accepted on my altar, for my house shall be called a house of prayer for all peoples. The Lord God, who gathers the outcasts of Israel, declares, I will gather yet others to him besides those already gathered.
Thank you. So there's a big idea that those who are excluded in the Old Testament, the foreigners and the eunuchs are excluded as well in the law, they'll all be brought in on equal terms with the outcasts. And that's just one, that's the one I could think of off the top of my head, but there are quite a few. And Paul does quote quite a few of them in Romans and says, look, the others will join in. So it's there. The one thing which is new in the New Testament isn't so much a promise of that happening and how great that will be. But we'll see after the next break that the one thing that's new in the New Testament is the time scale that Jesus comes in 2 bites. So that's the new revelation in the New Testament. But in terms of, if you go to Revelation 21, 22 in the end there, and you go through all those promises, and there are lots of them there, some explicit, some implicit, I don't think there's anything there which hasn't been promised by the end of the exile.
It's just
that
no, not yet.
Yeah.
This is more just sort of a, maybe it's just diagrammatically, I don't know. The Abrahamic covenant,
yes.
By the diagram, it looks like there's points in which it's fulfilled.
Yes.
Completely.
Yes. It does look like it, doesn't it? And to some extent, that's true. So Abram is told, your people will come in and get the land, and they do get it. But by that time, the promise has moved on. So if you like, again, you need to take the time scale. You can't say, well, at that point, Abram is fulfilled. It is. But at that point, the promises have become that. So the promises as they are at that point in time are never fulfilled at that same point in time. There's always a gap between promise and fulfillment all the way through.
There's also the promise to Abraham that all nations on earth will be brought to you.
That's right.
The closest you get is Solomon and King of Sheba, but Sheba is just a representative of the nations you've not got.
That's, you haven't got all of them. And the other thing is, Abraham is told that they'll have it forever. Only once, so I'm not made a big deal of it. And obviously they don't get it forever. You could say Solomon, that's where permanence is a big thing. But if at very least permanence is there in Abraham and David, but not Moses, obviously.
What do you mean by permanence?
I will give you the land forever and ever. My dwelling will be among them forever. And they obviously don't get that because they lose it all there because of sin. So if you like, you're getting these promises, but sin means it's still a huge chasm. Any other questions? Good. Let's take a loo break. If we can keep it to 10 minutes, that'd be... I don't hear too many noises, so hopefully there won't be a queue for coffee machines and loos. And then we have the third and final bit. Good, we're all here. I'm sorry, guys, that the breaks are getting shorter and shorter, but we do want to get lunch. We're still on track for lunch, but it won't be an early lunch. Any questions at this stage? People happy? Good, let's press on. So let's go to the end of the Old Testament. We've reached the exile. We're very near the end. There's not much of the Old Testament after the exile, but there is some. Israel is exiled to Babylon, but that doesn't last long. The Babylonian Empire is short-lived, and in 540 BC, the Persians conquer the whole area, and they allow the Jews to return. And the question is, are God's promises fulfilled in the return from Babylon? The way the promises are set up in the prophets, it does look like when they come back from Babylon, they'll all get all that's promised. Is that the case historically? And the answer is the return is described in the last few books of the Old Testament. Is that shut properly? Yeah. And what you see is... Sorry, I've just lost my place. The return is described in the last few books of the Old Testament, and these show that the return from Babylon after 540 was not what God has promised. So Jerusalem, they are allowed to return under the Persian Empire, but they still remain part of the Persian Empire. And Jerusalem remains under foreign rule for the whole of the rest of the Old Testament, and indeed, apart from a few decades, for the whole of the period, basically until 1945 AD. It's either under foreign... Yes, under foreign rule. Apart from a few decades. So there's no king of any sort, far less the great Davidic king. There is no new creation, and Israel keeps sinning, just as before the exile. And in fact, the very last note of the Old Testament is an account of Israel sinning. So Nehemiah 13 is the very, very last reference that you get to Judah, Israel, in the Old Testament. Pete, can you read Nehemiah 13, verses 23 to 27?
In those days, also I saw the Jews who had married women of Ashdod, Ammon and Moab, and half of their children spoke the language of Ashdod, and they could not speak the language of Judah, but the language of each people. And I confronted them and cursed them and beat some of them and pulled out their hair. And I made them swear in the name of God, saying, you shall not give your daughters to their sons or take their daughters for your sons or for yourselves. Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin on account of such women? Among the many nations, there was no king like him, and he was beloved by his God. And God made him king over Israel. Nevertheless, foreign women made even him to sin. Shall we then listen to you and do all this great evil and act treacherously against our God by marrying foreign women?
Thank you. I think there are four instances of sin in that last chapter in a little bit. Now, you could say, well, Nehemiah solved it, didn't he? But actually, that's the end of Nehemiah. At the beginning of Nehemiah, Nehemiah has exactly the same problem, and he solved it then, but it hasn't lasted. And 20 years before Nehemiah, Ezra had the same problem of intermarriage. That's the last two chapters of Ezra. And Ezra tried to solve it, and people repented, and it didn't last. So basically the point is, yes, you may have solved it, but it's not going to last. We are ending on a note of sin. And it's not just that they're sinning. There's hardly any sense of triumph at all. I think people are quite confused because you read a book like Nehemiah, and it does look like good things are happening within it. The thing that you need to understand in Nehemiah, the thing that I think transforms Nehemiah from a book of hope to realizing it's not a book of hope, is realizing that Nehemiah comes 100 years after the end of the exile. So we're not saying, if Nehemiah had happened right when they came back, you think, yep, we're on an upward trajectory. But to realize that a century after they get back, they're still in this position, helps you realize how little is actually happening. So let's have a look at a few more verses in Nehemiah just to see how little has happened after a century back in the land. Can you read chapter 1, verse 3, please, Pete?
And they said to me, the remnant there in the province who had survived the exile is in great trouble and shame. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates are destroyed by fire.
Thank you. So a century later, Jerusalem is still a ruined wreck. Nehemiah rebuilds it, but it's taken them a century to do that. And it's pretty pathetic what he does. Chapter 4, verses 2 and 3, please.
And he said in the presence of his brothers and of the army of Samaria, what are these feeble Jews doing? Will they restore it for themselves? Will they sacrifice? Will they finish in a day? Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of rubbish and burn ones at that? Tobiah the Ammonite was beside him, and he said, yes, what they are building, if a fox goes up on it, he will break down their stone wall. Hear, O our God, for we are despised. Turn back their torn from their heads and give them up to be plundered in a land where they are captives.
Thank you. So we all know that Nehemiah rebuilt the wall around Jerusalem, so the problem of chapter 1 gets solved to some extent, Nehemiah rebuilds it. But this is a description of what he's rebuilding. It is from the mouth of the enemy, so you need to take it with a suitable amount of salt, but it's probably not an unfair description. They rebuild it in just under 2 months. They do rebuild it with the rubble of the city. The fact it's a jerry-built work with burned-out rubble is a fair description. It is not a great solid wall which defends the city. It's another story, again, a fascinating detail, why the wall matters at this point, why even having this pretty rubbishy wall is a step forward. But in terms of actually fulfillment of promise, it is absolutely not glorious return, new creation type stuff. And can you read chapter 5, 1 to 5, please?
Now there arose a great outcry of the people and of their wives against their Jewish brothers. For there were those who said, with our sons and our daughters we are many, so let us get grain, that we may eat and keep alive. There were also those who said, we are mortgaging our fields, our vineyards and our houses to get grain because of the famine. And there were those who said, we have borrowed money for the king's tax on our fields and our vineyards. Now our flesh is as the flesh of our brothers, our children as their children. Yet we are forcing our sons and our daughters to be slaves, and some of our daughters have already been enslaved. But it is not in our power to help it, for other men have our fields and our vineyards.
Thank you. So they're back in the land, but all the things God promised, blessing, they don't have. Their famine's happening, they're in slavery, they're enslaving one another, they're in debt. It is not a time of peace and prosperity and happiness and blessing. And that's the point, effectively, of every single book which describes Israel after the exile. In one way or another, they are all saying it doesn't work. Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, they're all things saying you are sinful people still, and actually look how little is being fulfilled at this point. So you leave the Old Testament looking for God to rescue his people as he had promised, because it hasn't yet been fulfilled. But we have to wait for over 400 years before God begins to fulfill what he's promised. And that brings us to the New Testament, but let me have a question break. So that's the story of the Old Testament, a time of massive revelation, but a time of effectively no fulfillment. You get to the end of the exile and you come back, but actually you're at about that sort of level. This is not to scale, by the way. So much is that not to scale that I'm going to reclaim some of the space. Any questions?
Maybe this is a rubbish question. Why is Nehemiah and Ezra back way before even the Psalms in the canon? Why are they not after all the prophets?
Yeah. The answer is because the Old Testament isn't in historical order. What you get is all the historical books. And we have the English canon, which is basically the Greek canon as well. The Hebrew puts it in a slightly different order.
Yeah.
But the way it goes is you have the law, you have the effectively the history books, then you get the wisdom literature, then you get the prophets.
Yeah.
And the way it works, I'll tell you the short answer, but I'll do a whole weekend on this for the workers, RML, is... You have a massive, one of the massive things we don't realize, far bigger than you realize, is the shift of focus from a focus on this world, which is what Israel is all about, to a focus on the new creation. That is the thing which we still find one of the biggest challenges. Everybody in the world around us, and most of us instinctively, focus on this world. What's happening at the exile is God is saying, I'm not just making this world better, I'm actually going to give you a new creation. And the way it's set up is the wisdom literature, which comes basically at the high point of Israel's history there, talks about how little getting this world actually works. So Job is all about the fact that even a righteous man suffers, and one of the points made in Job is, and the wicked men prosper. So it's not working in this world. Ecclesiastes is basically saying, and even when you get what this world offers, remember Solomon writing Ecclesiastes, and even when you get everything that's promised, it's dust in your mouth, it doesn't satisfy, and death brings it all to an end. It's setting up the problem that this world doesn't work. So don't think that you can get fulfillment in this world, because actually the more you think about it as a wise man, the more you realize this world is futility. And the prophets then give the answer to that, because God is going to solve it by having a new creation. So why is it that the righteous men like Job suffer and wicked men prosper in this world? Because this world is not the end. Why is it you can get blessing in this world and it turns out to be utterly futile and frustrating, is Ecclesiastes? Answer, because this world is not the end. You will get blessings that genuinely satisfy. So if you like, you get the story, which we've seen here, finishing at Nehemiah, and then the big question of the shift from this creation to a new creation dealt with in the second half of the Old Testament.
It's
the short answer.
So when we do the overview, are we going to do it chronologically in terms of the order of the passages? Do we put Nehemiah?
Do Nehemiah after Isaiah and Ezekiel?
Yeah.
I find it a really hard study as a student, and I found it hard this last year while reading it. But the most helpful question was, what would we not know if we didn't have Nehemiah? Which is my favourite question about Nehemiah. I still find that really helpful.
And that's a really big, so that's a very important thing. So we will find that one of the things I hope will really come out of the overview is people seeing that the new creation is where God is driving towards. But they can know that in their head that that's the end story, but not believe it in their heart. And actually the whole wisdom literature and the prophets is there to help people realize it in their hearts. And we don't realize it because we don't spend nearly enough time there, because it's actually quite hard. Any other questions? Good.
What,
if, Rich?
What, do we do much about the kind of judgment side of it? Especially in the minor prophets?
No, we don't. So, thank you.
Judgment on the nation.
Judgment on the nation, judgment on Israel. So what I've done is that, but actually, just as those promises of blessing get much greater the exile, so actually, strictly speaking, what you get at the prophets as well is promise of much greater judgment.
Wow. It's going to get worse. You don't want it to get much worse than Moses. Still in the Mosaic Covenant. That's pretty bad anyway.
Yes. It is, but it does get worse. Much worse. Right, let's press on because otherwise we won't get lunch. We'll have Ali.
I was going to say,
go ahead.
And that might be one of the things that's new in the New Testament.
Yes.
The promise of hell. Is hell mentioned in the Old Testament?
Isaiah 66. Let's have a look at Isaiah 66. Yes, absolutely. Well, for everybody else who doesn't remember.
You're not going to catch you. You're like, the New Testament says it. Oh, it's quoting.
Let's have, just, Pete, can you read Isaiah 66, verses 22 to the end? And this is the very, very end of Isaiah. Okay, so this is the note the book ends on.
As for the new heavens and the new earth that I make, shall remain before me, says the Lord. So shall your offspring and your name remain. From new moon to new moon, and from Sabbath to Sabbath, all flesh shall come to worship before me, declares the Lord. And they shall go out and look on the dead bodies of the men who have rebelled against me, for their worm shall not die, their fire shall not be quenched, and thou shall be an abhorrence to all flesh.
So Isaiah, which is this tremendous book of hope and new creation and resurrection, ends on a note of hell. But it just in those last three verses, you get both extremes. New heavens and new earth, two verses. Hell, one verse, as the note the book ends on. Good, I'll press on. We'll have more time for questions. The New Testament opens by saying that Jesus is coming to fulfill the Old Testament promises we've been looking at. So what is the earliest bit of the New Testament? Answer, Luke 1. It is before Jesus is even born, is Luke chapter 1. Pete, can you read Luke 1, verses 69 to 65? Let me tell you what you're looking out for as Pete reads it. In Luke 1, 69 to 65, Zechariah, who is John the Baptist's father, is making a prophecy at the time of John the Baptist's birth. And what he says is that God is now coming to fulfill promises. As he reads, see which promises are fulfilled and which ones are not.
Luke 1, 61 to 65. And they said to her, none of your relatives is called by this name. And they made signs to his father, inquiring what he wanted him to be called. And he asked for a writing tablet and wrote, his name is John. And they all wondered. And immediately his mouth was opened and his tongue loosed, and he spoke, blessing God. And fear came on all their neighbours, and all these things were talked about through all the hill country of Judea.
Sorry, 69 to 75.
Oh, 69 to 75.
Yes.
Sorry.
Yes. I thought you were reading the wrong thing. I thought, sure, I don't remember.
It's quite weird that they made John.
Which chapters were you reading?
I was reading 61 to 65.
65 to 69.
Oh, great. And fear came on all their neighbours. On all these things. This is 65.
Yeah.
Yeah. And all fear came on all their neighbours. And all these things were talked about through all the hill country of Judea, and all who heard them laid them upon their hearts, up in their hearts, saying, what then will this be? For the hand of the Lord was with him. And his father, Zechariah,
was filled with the Holy Spirit and prophesied, saying, "Blessed be the Lord God of Israel, for he has visited and redeemed his people, and has raised up a horn of salvation for us in the house of his servant David, as he spoke by the mouth of his holy prophets from of old, that we should be saved from our enemies and from the hand of all who hate us, to show the mercy promised to our fathers and to remember his holy covenant, the oath that he swore to our father Abraham to grant us, that we, being delivered from the hand of our enemies, might serve him without fear, in holiness and righteousness before him all our days. And you, child, will be called the prophet of the Most High, for you will go before the Lord to prepare his ways, to give knowledge of salvation to his people in the forgiveness of their sins, because of the tender mercy of our God, whereby the sunrise shall visit us from on high, to give light to those who sit in darkness and in the shadow of death, to guide our feet into the way of peace."
Thank you. So you'll notice that he's saying God is coming to work to fulfill the oath sworn to Abraham, what was promised to David, and what was spoken through the prophets. The three great unconditional covenants, promises, are restated. Moses is not. Now, this is, again, an example. You read the New Testament and you see that, and you think, yeah, great things will happen. But until you've read the Old Testament through, you don't realize the significance of the fact that it's Abraham, David, and prophets mentioned, and not Moses. But now I hope we do see the significance of that. There is no condition, possibility of curse, but all the blessings instead. But in what way does Jesus fulfill all that God has promised? So Zechariah says, this is what God is doing, fulfilling all that God has promised. I don't know about you guys, but I still sin, and all the people I know still sin. And I'm not inhabiting a new creation. I'm old enough to know my body is falling apart, and I'm getting sick and old and decrepit. And you probably are as well. We don't have a new creation. We aren't sinless. We don't have peace. We don't have prosperity. So how has Jesus fulfilled all that God has promised? And the answer is that Jesus' coming is a two-stage affair. And that's the big, big revelation of the New Testament. With some of what God has been, of what God has promised being fulfilled at the first coming and some at the second coming. And it's crucial to see what is fulfilled at each and why, because it's not accidental, it's not random. It's really, really significant what is being fulfilled at the first coming and what is fulfilled at the second. At his first coming, Jesus fulfills four key promises. First of all, obviously, he is the Davidic king who is God himself. As we saw all the way through the Old Testament, when the king comes, who will be God himself, Isaiah, that's when God will bring about all that he has promised. The king has now appeared. He has begun to do the job God has given him. And the New Testament makes clear that Jesus is God himself. And that's the big point of John's gospel that the students, first years, will be studying this year. Secondly, he is the sacrifice who fully cleanses us from sin. Pete, can you read Hebrews 9? Hebrews 9. From halfway through 26, I think there's a paragraph break there. 26b to 28, please.
"For as it is, he has appeared once for all at the end of the ages to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. And just as it is appointed for man to die once, and after that comes judgment, so Christ, having been offered once to bear the sins of many, will appear a second time, not to deal with sin, but to save those who are eagerly waiting for him."
Thank you. So the dealing with sin is what happens at the first coming, not the second. He has done it. It's a sacrifice which has fully worked. Thirdly, he inaugurates the promised new covenant. Luke 22, please, Pete. Keep a finger in Hebrews. We'll come back to it in a second.
Luke 22.
Verse 20. And just let me set up the significance of that before you read it. The prophets in the Old Testament don't actually make the new covenant. So whereas when the covenant is made to Abraham, Moses, and David is actually made, what's happening there is it's a promise of a new covenant rather than the covenant actually made. one day I will come and make a new covenant, is what God says. Luke 22:20.
And likewise, the cup after they had eaten, saying, "This cup that is poured out for you is the new covenant in my blood."
Thank you. So when is the new covenant actually made? At the cross. It's a big thing Jesus does, is inaugurate this new covenant. And let's go back to Hebrews chapter 8, verses 8 to 13, to see what this new covenant actually promises. Again, yes, chapter 8, verses 8 to 13. Let me again set it up a little bit. Have a look at the fact that this is a new covenant and what covenant it's replacing, how it works. Pete.
He finds fault with him when he says, "Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will establish a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not like the covenant that I have made with their fathers on the day when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt. For they did not continue in my covenant, and so I showed no concern for them, declares the Lord. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my laws into their minds and write them on their hearts. And I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And they shall not teach each one his neighbour and each one his brother, saying, Know the Lord, for they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest. For I will be merciful towards their iniquities, and I will remember their sins no more."
Keep going.
In speaking of a new covenant, he makes the first one obsolete. And what is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away.
Thank you. So you have a new covenant which replaces the covenant made when I brought them out of Egypt. So this is what I said is the biggest strand in the New Testament, and it's the one we're particularly focusing on. The new covenant is not the only one, but it's the clearer one. The new covenant is replacing that covenant, and the difference between them is that one depended on Israel obeying, and they didn't. This one depends on God doing it, and it will therefore work and render that one obsolete.
Only renders that one
incomplete. That's right. It's only
so
that one.
The Abrahamic covenant and the Davidic covenant still go on.
Brilliant.
But the Mosaic covenant doesn't.
That's right. And it's made explicit because as you look at that passage, it tells you which covenant it is that's being made obsolete.
And it's singular as well, not the covenant.
Yeah. And those, the Abrahamic and the Davidic, but particularly the Abrahamic, cannot be made obsolete. Because when you look at Abraham, and we'll look at that when we won't deal with it now, God has committed himself on oath to fulfilling it on a basis of, I cannot never break this covenant under any circumstance.
And interestingly, we look at chapter 15. The chapter 15 in Genesis, God says, I'm going to do both parts of this.
That's right. So that's the one we'll look at when we do the studies. And it's really, I think, quite exciting to look at that. I think God says, If I don't give you these promises, Abraham, may I be chopped in two? May I cease to be God? I mean, it's an astonishing promise, how certain it is. And it's done right at the beginning of the story. So as you go through all these twists and turns, and it looks all horrible, if you remember your Genesis 15, stated there, you know that whatever is happening here, it cannot undo the fact that at the end is good. So again, as you read the story forward, if you're reading it intelligently, you're thinking, I've got a solid stake in the ground. God has committed himself to working it out somehow. I don't know how. It looks like the wheels are going in every direction and the car's upside down in the ditch. But God will make it right somehow. Any other questions? Good, let's press on. Because there's a fourth thing. I've said the four things and we've done three. He is the promised king who's God himself. He is the sacrifice who really deals with sin. He has inaugurated the new covenant where God will solve the problem himself, not us. And fourthly, he's the one who gives God's people the Holy Spirit. John 16, verse 7. Sachi preached on this the other week in the morning for those of you who were there. John 16, 7.
Nevertheless, I tell you the truth, it is to your advantage that I go away. For if I do not go away, the Helper will not come to you. But if I go, I will send him to you.
Thank you. So you read John, and that's quite an exciting thing that you're going to get a Helper. Read the Old Testament going forward, And you realize the Spirit has been promised there in Ezekiel as the one who will help. And now Jesus is, it's not that God does it without Jesus. Jesus goes to send him. Jesus is instrumental, not just in being the sacrifice and the inaugurator of the covenant and the king, but as the sender of the Holy Spirit. He really is doing it all. The Spirit has many roles in the fulfillment of God's plan, but the key one for our purposes is he's the one who regenerates us and begins to change us from within to solve this problem of sin. So can you see that the crucial first step of dealing with sin has been fully accomplished by the coming of Jesus? So we separated right at the beginning of the morning the cause of the fall, sin, from the effects. And what we have at this point in the story, if I can avoid tripping over Pete's feet, is basically nothing more gets promised. Sin remains a big problem. And exciting change of color. Is this red?
Yep.
Yes. Colorblind for those of you who don't know me seriously. Jesus comes and sin is no longer a problem because of the cross. And that's the really big thing Jesus does at his first coming. So he hasn't dealt with any of the effects. We still die, we still live in a world that's cursed, we don't have a new creation, we're still out of the new creation. But half the problem is solved. Sin is not a problem any longer. So many of God's promises are actually fulfilled in Jesus' first coming by the fact that sin is dealt with, that sometimes the New Testament speaks of God's promises as already being fulfilled. So those of you who have done Romans know that in Romans 8 verse 30, we're said that we have already been glorified in him. Ephesians 1 says we have every blessing in him. And the New Testament puts it that way because spiritually we have already obtained all those things. We just don't have them in our grubby paws yet. So 1 Peter puts it as we have an inheritance stored up for us in heaven. It's ours, we just don't have it. But we will certainly have it because the thing which is stopping us having it, which is sin, has been fully dealt with. But our actual experience of it, our enjoyment of it, will only happen when Jesus returns, which is his second coming. Completely pleased to know we're on the home straight. So if you're flagging, deep breath, we're almost there. At his second coming, Jesus will finish off accomplishing everything that God has promised by doing two other things. So there are two big things that happens when Jesus returns. First, he will judge the whole world and punish all God's enemies by casting them into hell. God will not tolerate rebellion forever. He's simply deferring judgment until he's finished his plan to rescue his people. Can I get rid of this from here? No, I can't. That's stuck on. Basically, you'll have to imagine. No, I can probably just get away with it. That goes on there, promise of hell. Jesus comes. You actually get some improvement of things with Jesus coming because we get things like the Holy Spirit. So we go on. That's for God's people. For the people who aren't God's people, you get that. And then you get is one of the big things that happens. So, sorry, what I drew there while you're all thinking is Jesus comes, and for his people, things do get even better still, even in this world, because we have things like the Spirit allowing us to have a relationship with God. But for the people who are not his people, you're getting a parting of the ways. And for the not his people, judgment in the end when he comes. And for those who are his people when he comes, you get new creation. So when he comes again, dotted line because we don't know how long it's going to be, we get the new creation. And as we did at the very beginning of the morning, you can go through all the categories in Revelation 21 and 22 and just see how God has fulfilled all that he has promised in all those areas that we've been tracking all the way through the morning, that you'll be tracking all the way through the year. And you can see that at the new creation, God's people will be in perfect relationship with God. He will be both Father and Son. We'll be married to Jesus. We'll be his body. There'll be no temple because God is with us. We'll see him face to face. Revelation 21, 22 is full of allusion to how perfect the relationship will be. We will be in the new creation, which will be a new eternal home. Wonderful. Nothing will go wrong because there'll be no curse. In fact, God will be there looking after us. In the new creation, we'll live forever and not die. In the new creation, the Spirit will finish off the job of making us sinless. In the new creation, Jesus will reign visibly over everything. Does that make sense? So just whistle stop. Run, but we've looked at Revelation 21, 22 earlier. Happy? The balance between Jesus' first coming and second coming, the one-liner, the one verse which gives you the one-liner is Hebrews 9, 28. Pete, can you read that for us again, please? Hebrews 9, 28.
So Christ, having been offered once to bear the sins of many, will appear a second time, not to deal with sin, but to save those who are eagerly waiting for him.
Thank you. So he came the first time to deal with sin. He'll come the second time to save those who are waiting for him. Now, that's oversimplified because we still sin, so sin hasn't been fully dealt with. And we do have a foretaste of the salvation in the Spirit. But as a one-liner, you cannot better that verse. Sin in the first coming, salvation in the second. Cause of the fall, results of the fall. Cause of the fall dealt with at the first coming, results of the fall dealt with at the second coming. So that's why I said it's worth right up front in the Genesis 1 to 3 study and very clearly in the Abraham and Moses stuff, just drawing a distinction between cause and effect, cause and effect. Because when you get to the New Testament, the first coming of Jesus deals with the cause completely in four different ways. And the second coming will deal with the effects, all of them. So this is where sort of knowing the overall plot, which is what we're trying to do this morning, will help you as you teach to make sure you're focusing on the elements that will contribute to people understanding the big thing really clearly. Does that make sense? Any questions?
How explicit to make that for group members?
Yes, it depends slightly on the group. I think it's worth it. I wouldn't tell them necessarily right up front that that's what's going to happen in the New Testament. But saying something like, it's really worth keeping the cause and the effect separate in our mind, but just so we can understand, because they're two conceptually different things. Mm. That's worth saying. And just all the saying, so what have we seen? Or not all this, but whenever it's relevant, saying, so what's this done about the cause? What's this done about the effects? Yeah. Can be quite helpful. Any other questions?
With when it says in Hebrews that it says that it deals with sin, doesn't it just deal with the kind of the judgment that sin deserves? Jesus doesn't actually deal with the problem in sin in man's heart. That's only going to happen at the second coming when we're given a new heart by God.
Well, he begins it. By giving us the Holy Spirit and by inaugurating the new covenant. Sorry, Neil?
And he's being a priest.
Yes.
That's right.
So it's begun, but it isn't, you're right, it isn't fulfilled. It isn't completely that. That's why I said 9:28, it is not as neat as that. But if you want a one-liner, you can't improve on that.
Yeah.
But one-liners are never good enough to capture everything. So it isn't that sin is fully dealt with. We still sin. But the penalty of sin is fully dealt with.
Mm-hmm.
The covenant that says what's going to happen to that sin and what God's going to do has been fully inaugurated. The Spirit who will actually, in the end, solve the problem has been given us. And we haven't seen it, but those of you who have done Romans know that in a sense, we inside the real me has been transformed, Romans chapter 7. I love the law of God in my inner being. So a lot of things have happened. It's just the sinful flesh will not do what I want to do.
Yeah. My other question is,
here we've got God's people's experience goes up.
Yeah.
But isn't there a sense in which actually, if anything, it goes down? So deny yourself, take up your cross and follow me.
Yeah.
Is in some sense a downward stroke.
You could say that. So again, you could. This is quite the question of how much you add, how complicated you get it. So I suppose I'm just making it simple by saying, let's just focus on, we get the spirit, things have gotten a bit better.
I guess in terms of promises, it's...
Yeah.
So having God dwelling in you must be better than not.
That's right. Even if being put to death and...
just what you perceive it to be.
Yes.
It's about perception.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess it's more, that's more of tracing a life of promise fulfillment rather than just life experience.
Mm.
And that will be there.
Yeah.
Any other questions? I still have a page and a half of notes, but they're so. That's not the end. That's the end of the story. The page and a half notes deal with other things like. That killed the question. Let me deal with a page and a half, and then we'll have a genuine. That's the end. You can ask anything you like. So one of the what we've. Track through all the way there is how God. So we set ourselves several questions, if you remember back to the beginning of the morning, if your brain is live enough to do that. We set ourselves several questions there. One was, how is God going to fulfill those promises, both in terms of how this promise just to Abraham of a little bit of land in the Middle East is going to turn into a new creation. And we've seen how that has evolved. We set ourselves a challenge of, how is sin going to be solved? And we've seen how sin is going to be solved. So how God is going to fulfill the promise, we have now seen. When God is going to fulfill the promise, we've also seen, not to a date because we don't know, but actually half of it is done now, the second half of Jesus' second coming. But another issue we set ourselves right up front there with Abraham was, who benefits? Everybody is affected by the fall. Who benefits from the covenant to Abraham? All the way through from there to there, it looks like it's Israel. But when you get to the New Testament, you realize it isn't. So all the way through, the promises to Abraham's descendants, and all the way through the Old Testament, apart from, as Ali implied earlier, a few promises in the prophets which begin to move us forward. But what it looks like through most of the Old Testament is, it looks like Abraham's physical descendants are the descendants God is referring to. But as the story goes on, we see that's not the case. Israel is cursed, not blessed. The prophets say only a remnant of Israel will benefit from what God is doing. She doesn't get it. In the New Testament, everything becomes clear, and you realize the descendants are those who have Abraham's faith, not his flesh. For fairly obvious reasons when you think about it, all the way through, the emphasis is not this world things like genes and physical characteristics, but spiritual things, new creation, which faith is the bigger deal of. So the real descendants are those who have Abraham's faith. And anyone from any nation, hence Genesis 12:3, who has that faith can inherit God's promises. Can you read Galatians 3, verses 6 to 9, please? And this is the main reason we do the Galatians passage when we get to it.
Galatians 3, 6 to 9. Just as Abraham believed God, and it was counted to him as righteousness, know then that it is those of faith who are the sons of Abraham. And the scripture, foreseeing that God would justify the Gentiles by faith, preached the gospel beforehand to Abraham, saying, in you shall all the nations be blessed. So then, those who are of faith are blessed, along with Abraham, the man of faith.
Thank you. So that promise in Genesis 3 of all the nations will be blessed for you is explicitly mentioned here, and you're told it's every. Yep, this is the way it's going to be fulfilled. Everybody who has Abraham's faith. So the question then is, what's the nation of Israel doing? If they never were the people who were going to inherit, if it always was those of faith intended from the beginning, what's the nation of Israel doing? And the answer is, the nation of Israel is there to teach us. The whole Old Testament is there to teach us. So we don't understand Jesus. We cannot understand Jesus without the Old Testament. And the whole Old Testament is there to teach us, and Israel is no exception. She is there to teach us. So the New Testament says that the Old Testament is a shadow or a picture of the reality that's revealed in Jesus, so that we can grasp the reality better when we get there. Can you read Hebrews 10 verse 1, please?
For since the law has but a shadow of the good things to come instead of the true form of these realities, it can never, by the same sacrifices that are continually offered every day, every year, make perfect those who draw near.
Thank you. And Colossians 2:17, please.
These are a shadow of things to come. Substance belongs to Christ.
Thank you. So it's a shadow, it's a picture. When you read the Old Testament, realizing this is not the real thing, you realize how many pictures there are of Jesus in it. How much help a king is, you see that there. What the nation looks like, what it means to be blessed, you see pictures of it there. So that when Jesus comes, you understand him and what he's doing. So there are all sorts, in the New Testament, there are all sorts of categories of Jesus as king, Jesus as priest, Jesus as prophet. How do you understand those? I mean, how many of us have heard talks saying, Jesus is our king. Now, what do we mean by king? Well, king, by king, we don't mean the Queen of England. And you're trying to explain it using secular categories today because we haven't read the story through. The Bible actually tells you what king actually means biblically. So that when you get there, you understand it. The Bible tells you what a priest really is. So when you get to Jesus being priest, you understand him. It's setting up. It's all there so you understand Jesus when you get to him. Now, people will then say, isn't that unfair to the Israelites just to be a picture? But the answer is any Israelite who believed, Abraham, Moses, Joshua, David, Caleb, they're all in the new creation. They all benefit as well. So you can benefit just as much as we can there. But they have a second role. They have the privilege of a second role of also being an object lesson to the rest of the world.
And almost more than that, they're also the mechanism by which God achieves his purpose.
Yes.
Because from them comes Jesus.
Yes, exactly.
Comes the explanation.
Yeah. Exactly. So the danger is... People overestimate what happens in Jesus in Israel. They think it's the answer, and it absolutely isn't. But then you can go from that to the negative. Oh, isn't it horribly unfair on them? Which is also not true. There's somewhere in the middle, there's a happy compromise. Does that make sense? And the final area I want to deal with before we have lunch, which we will get to before the queue dies down, I hope, is just to deal with applying the overview. I would like to have done this as a separate session, but we don't have a separate session on it. But just spend a few minutes on thinking how to apply it, because application is such a big deal, but applying the overview is very different to applying anything else. And it's really different because two-thirds of our time in the overview, maybe three-quarters, we're in the Old Testament, and we don't live in Old Testament times. We are not only are we not David and not Abraham, and not Moses, in many ways, we're not even Israel. So we say to people, as you read the Old Testament, don't think you're David, don't think you're Moses, you are Israel, which is true to some extent. But actually, when you push it a little bit harder, we aren't even Israel. Israel is told that they have to do things like keep the sacrifices, not work on the Sabbath. Lots of things which no longer apply to us because we're not in that period. So you need to be really careful. So how do we apply the overview? I said it's revolutionary and transforming, but how? And the answer is, it applies to us at the most fundamental level because it challenges and changes completely our perception of what the world is all about and where it's going. In other words, the worldview. When you change a person's worldview, you change them completely. If I tell you that you need to be have a quiet time every day, you can do it as an issue of discipline, or not, depending on how disciplined you are. But it's hard work. You don't really want to. You just know you ought to. If you realize what a privilege it is to have a relationship with God and how a relationship with God is one of the biggest things God is driving towards in the whole Bible, and everything is focused on that. And that's what eternity is all about. And you can have a foretaste of that now because he's given you the privilege of speaking to him and having a relationship with him, son to father. And you really begin to get that. Then your quiet times in your relationship with him don't become a duty and a hardship, but a thrill and a joy. But that happens at the motivational level when your worldview is changed. And the overview is about changing people's worldview so they see the world differently. They see the world the way that God sees the world. There are all sorts of ways in which being a Christian is actually about changing a worldview. So right from two ways to live, you change the worldview. You're on people's worldview saying, people think that we rule the world, the crown on our head. I run my life. I'm in charge. But actually, the Bible's worldview is God's in charge, not me. That's a worldview change, isn't it? The whole of Bible application is about changing the worldview at all sorts of levels. And I think that's true wherever you are. So when you're applying Mark, when you're applying Romans, when you're applying John, whatever you're studying, changing the worldview is much more fundamental than changing actions. But when you study a New Testament book, it's very easy to flip between the two because we're in the same sort of period. It's much more blurred distinction. When you're in the Old Testament, you have to be clear that what you're trying to change is people's worldview. And let me just give you two examples of worldviews that the Old Testament should change. Firstly, what is the big thing that all non-Christians are focused on? This world. My comfort, my success, my happiness, my security. Or, if you're not quite so selfish, our security, our prosperity, our contentment, our peace. But there is no non-Christian who isn't concerned about this world, either at the level of the individual or the corporate. That is just the world. But the Bible is saying God is not concerned about this world. He's concerned about that. That is, if you like, the most fundamental change in worldview you can have, because it basically says to every Christian in all your groups, all the stuff that you are living for, your exam results, your career choice afterwards, the marriage you're going to be involved with, your possessions, your fun, your popularity, they are all irrelevant in eternity. What God is concerned about in eternity, that is what matters infinitely more than anything and everything in this world. And if people get that, it will so transform them in terms of what they want, what they live for, what they're prepared to sacrifice for the sake of the gospel. You don't have to tell them you have to give up these things for the gospel. They will just realize the worthlessness of this compared to that, if they really get that. So really understanding that that's what God is driving through all the way, and the whole Bible is saying, actually, what happens here doesn't work. Look, you try it and you try it and you try it, and you end up there. Just begins to help people see, actually, the new creation is what matters, the worldview change. The other one is the one I've already mentioned, relationship with God. Relationship with God right from Moses, well, from the fall onwards, is a really big deal. So you don't have to tell your students, have a quiet time, read your Bible, say your prayer. If you can change their worldview so they realize how much relationship with God is a privilege, not a duty, you've changed it from something I ought to do to something I want to do, which completely changes what people will actually do with it. Does that make sense? And those are just two examples of many, but be thinking all the way through, not so much how I change people's actions, but how I change their motivations and their attitudes. For those of you who are theologically inclined, the Puritans talked about it in terms of changing their affections, which is the same thing. What you want. That is the big deal. And that's what I think should happen in all Bible study, but in the overview more than anywhere. If you don't keep that in your mind, you will end up in all sorts of confusions. People want to go away and sacrifice a goat or kill the Canaanites. Does that make sense? Everybody happy? And let me just now answer the question I set up at the very beginning. So what are the big theological challenges of our time that the overview will help us with? Two big things. First of all, postmodernism is utterly opposed to the idea that there's one plan that spans all history and affects everybody. That is one of the pet hatreds of postmodernism. So the whole, that's okay for you, and I have my own way of looking at things, which is absolutely the heart of postmodernism. The Bible overview says just is not the case. God doesn't have a plan for those who are his people. God has a plan for the whole world. He made it, he rules it, he'll judge it. He will rescue people from it. Whether you're a postmodernist or not.
Hey.
Hello.
Yeah.
Nice to see you back. You're just here for the last 30 seconds or so, but come and get. I'm just answering the question I set up before you left, which is what are the greatest theological challenges of our ages that the overview deals with? First, postmodernism. There is one plan that affects everybody, whether they like it or not. Secondly, the world hates the idea that the world is not the center of everything. And through most of the church at the present moment, one of the biggest issues is, where is God focused on, this world or the next? So if you whether it's the health wealth gospel that basically says it's all about me and what I get, my health, my wealth, my prosperity, whether it's part of the charismatic movement and my experience and what I do as a Christian, whether it's parts of the church that focus on, as Christians, our responsibility is to do things with social justice and a restoration of all that is wrong in the world. In almost every part of the church, it is something or other to do with this world that people are focused on. Isn't that right? It's maybe different elements of this world, depending which part of the church you're in. My blessings or my experience or us as a community, but it's something to do with this world. But the overview, Bible as a whole, says it isn't. It is nothing to do with this world. Whichever it is not arguing about whether it's my health versus social justice. It is about this world versus a new creation. And that, I think, is one of the biggest challenges of our age. So the two biggest challenges that we face at the present moment, throughout the history of the church, 2,000 years of church history, there have basically been about four big issues that have been fought over. For the first 500 years of the church's history, it was the nature of God. Is Jesus fully God? Is he God like God? How does the Trinity work? That's just a challenge for the first 500 years. It hasn't gone away, but it's much less of an issue today. For about 400 years at the time of the Reformation, the big issue is, how am I saved? Faith or works? And it's still there. It hasn't gone away, but we're fairly clear on the issues. For the 300 years since the Enlightenment, the big issue is, how do I know? Where is truth? Postmodernism is just part of that. And understanding the Bible as a whole begins to deal with that. And the issue we're just going into now for the last 50 years or so, and going forward, I suspect, indefinitely, is this world versus the next. When and where is God focused on? And again, seeing the Bible as a whole answers that. So two of, I think, the four biggest challenges of the whole of church history. We're in the middle of a transition from the one to the other. And seeing the Bible as a whole really deals with those two. Does that make sense? And that is all I have. So that really is the end. You can ask any questions you have, and we can go for lunch when we're done.
Haven't you got any practical advice for keeping application fresh in terms of kind of, I can either stuck to the same kinds of questions those weeks?
Yeah. I am quite radical, and I think we over-focus on application. I'm going to be provocative. I'm not very often provocative, but those of you who know me know that's a lie. I think that when we focus on application, we're basically being very man-centered. For most of us, the application question is, tell me about me and what I should do. So we study the Bible passage, which tells me all about God and what he's doing. And then at the end, we say, okay, God, enough of you. What about me? What should I do? And I think we want to say, woo, and say, let's just stay at the level of God and what he's done. And in a sense, let it change the worldview. So that wildly overstates the case, but just be careful with application. We all like it because it's actually about me.
Michael, come back to what you said at the end about Israel's role within the Bible is to teach us the need for God, the sort of problem, the need for Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Then the sort of the obsession that some evangelical Christians have about Israel's place in the second coming, does the Bible, what we're saying is that actually that's a misfocus of people's...
That's a complete misunderstanding, exactly right. And again, it's a result of trying to not seeing that the Bible has a plot that moves forward. So you see a promise to Israel. There are promises to Israel there of, I will do this for Israel. And you take that and you think that still applies exactly as stands verbatim, and it causes all sorts of confusion. But read the plot forward and you realize that Israel has changed definition from the nation of Israel to the church. Jerusalem has changed definition from a city in the Middle East to a city in the new creation. There, as the plot moves forward, a lot of these terms have set up categories which have changed their definition as the plot has evolved. And if you don't follow it through and see how it's changed, you get all sorts of confusion. And this, and just another example of why seeing it's a plot that moves forward and you have to understand the plot and how it's moved is crucial to rightly understanding what God is doing. I mean, it's crucial. You can't overstate how crucial it is to understand the plot going forward. That's the way God has revealed it, and you don't understand what he's doing. If you think I can just drop into any random bit of the Bible, see what's said and take it to me as though that it's not part of a plot. Ali?
That must be wrong.
But
is there not still some significance to the physical descendants of Abraham and the physical land of Israel? For example, Romans 11.
Yeah. Romans 11 will tell, and I think Romans 9 to 11 is really the place to go to the answer to that. Tells you that there's significance to the people, but the significance is completely different to what people understand. So the significance is not that they are more saved or differently saved. Paul couldn't be more explicit that they're saved in exactly the same terms as everybody else. Their significance is more they were the vessels through whom that revelation was given originally, and they still have a function, almost as sort of the litmus test of when God will come to do the final rescue. The land of Israel is more tricky. Does it still have any significance? I'm not sure there's anywhere in the New Testament that says it does. It may or may not. There's some verses in the Old Testament you think, is there still something of significance? But if it is, it's just where the last battle will be fought, but as opposed to where fulfillment is. But it may not even be that. Even that could be a metaphor for something else, because the New Testament doesn't suggest there's any significance to the land. It does to the people in Romans 9 to 11, but not the land. Unless you can think of a counterexample for me.
So, yeah, the people. So.
The people, but it's different to what you think.
So I guess, the references to, in the prophets at the time of the exile and then in Revelation, to locations in the promised land. But, as you say, the category of promised land has changed, so...
So in the New Testament, for example, in four chapters we don't look at in the overview, but you might want to for yourself. Just before you get to the New Jerusalem in Revelation 21 and 22, in I think Revelation 17 to 20, you get described the fall of Babylon. Now clearly Babylon at that point is not Babylon as a place in the Middle East. It is clearly a metaphor. So if Babylon is clearly a metaphor, how much are the physical references to Jerusalem and the land and place a metaphor as well? Any other questions? Sorry, that was jolly hard work. There's a lot there. But I hope that's given you some idea of how the whole thing holds together. And as I said, do your level best to make sure that the big picture comes out. Much more than, I think this is really true for Mark and Romans as well, that we need to work much harder in those books to see how the book works as a book, not just each passage. But in the overview, much more than Mark and Romans, seeing the big picture is the whole object of the exercise. If you have 27 great studies and you get really excited by creation and flood and promise and rescue and king and exile, but you don't see how they hold together, you have missed the whole point of what we're trying to do, which is see God has a plan. And the plan climaxes there. So the big applications aren't coming out of the little bits. The big applications are coming out of the worldview change that happens when you see how the whole thing coheres.
How will you know if you're doing the latter and getting the big picture rather than doing 27 minute-long studies? What will be
I think the group members' answers. So I would probably aim to spend much more time than usual in a study saying, so how does this study add to what we... Not just... So when you say fit, which I think is a question we all use, I think people don't never answer that correctly. So when you say fit, people tend to say something like, oh, we've seen this idea before, or this is how it fits with last week's study. But you want to basically say, how is it moving the... Maybe moving the plot forward is the better way. How is this moving the plot forward, the story forward? And the other thing to do to keep people looking in both directions, what questions are we still left with in the overall plot?
And what do we not understand yet? And
that's
what
right.
What hasn't been answered?
Yes.
Or answered?
That's right.
That's really helpful.
So,
rather than, I've got to the end of this and I completely understand everything.
Yes.
That's actually a reliable warning
signal. Brilliant. Exactly right. So people really want to reach closure at the end of every study and helping realize that actually, you can't reach closure till you reach Revelation 22. And being uncertain halfway through is actually not failure, but success is actually quite important. Any other questions? I suggest we spend 3 or 4 minutes praying briefly in some of these things, then go for lunch before they stop serving it.